Up next on Boston Public Radio, another politician is forced to apologize. Our question, when is an apology sincere and a sincere one enough?
Then a guy who ran for mayor in the 90s, Chris Lydon, will join us to talk about the 20-plus years in office of the guy who beat him, Tom Menino, and whether he deserves four more.
The best, most mouth-watering burger in town? We'll find out.
And this is big. She's in your home virtually every night as the voice of Lisa Simpson, and now she wants to be in your closet, too. Yardley Smith joins us in studio to talk Simpsons and shoes. That's all next on Boston Public Radio.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Obama is reaffirming his commitment to supporting Israeli security in a Jerusalem speech described as the cornerstone of his visit to the region this week. Speaking to an audience dominated by university students, Obama also pressed for revived peace efforts between Israel and the Palestinians. He criticized Israel over its treatment of Palestinians who live in the West Bank, but he also said Palestinian statehood bids at the United Nations was the wrong way to go.
There is no question that the only path to peace is through negotiations, which is why, despite the criticism we've received, the United States will oppose unilateral efforts to bypass negotiations through the United Nations. It has to be done by the parties.
Obama's remarks came just hours after he met with Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas. The U.S. House has passed a bill to keep the government operating through September 30th. The measure that had already passed the Senate averts a government shutdown next week. It gives the military and some domestic agencies more flexibility to cope with $85 billion in automatic spending cuts. Cyprus is fighting to stave off bankruptcy and the potential danger of leaving the eurozone. The government is in the final stages of cross-party talks to raise the equivalent of $7.5 billion in order to secure an EU loan. From the capital, John Seropoulos reports on Cyprus's Plan B.
The government is expected to create an asset pile out of public pension funds, the major high street banks, and private donations. Those include an offer by the church to mortgage its entire property holdings. The government would then issue bonds on this so-called solidarity fund. This is being done to avoid taking up to 10% of people's savings in a one-time levy. Parliament blocked that idea after a massive outcry from Cypriots and overseas investors. But some sort of levy could still be necessary, and the pressure has just been upped. The European Central Bank will cease emergency cash flows to two insolvent banks by Monday if Plan B isn't approved, and that could lead to a collapse of Cyprus' entire financial sector. For NPR News, I'm John Seropoulos in Nicosia.
An alliance of native groups from the U.S. and Canada has vowed to fight proposed oil pipelines in both countries. Dan Karpinchuk reports that'll happen through various actions.
They're not saying yet what those other actions might be, but one chief says native people in both the U.S. and Canada have a lot of issues at stake, and it will be a long, hot summer. Phil Lane, Jr. of the Yankton Sioux in the U.S. says native groups south of the border will stand with their Canadian cousins and stop the pipelines one way or another. A Western Canadian chief says opponents of the pipelines will never back down. The alliance is opposed to both the Northern Gateway and Keystone XL pipelines, both controversial. The first would tie the Alberta oil sands to the West Coast, while the second would send oil to refineries on the American Gulf Coast. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
Dow's down 36. This is NPR News.
From the WGBH Radio Newsroom in Boston, I'm Drew Dawson with the local stories we're following. The race for mayor this year in Boston is taking shape. City Councilor John Connolly launched his campaign last night with an address and concert. Although five-term Mayor Tom Menino has not yet announced whether he'll seek another term, the mayor has lots to say about Connolly. In an interview with WGBH's Emily Rooney, Menino asked what Connolly has done as a city councilor.
Yeah, nice guy's important. But the most important thing to me and to the public is, what have you done to make life a little bit easier for them?
You can watch Emily's entire interview with Mayor Menino tonight on Greater Boston at 7 p.m. on WGBH2. The Coast Guard says about 350 gallons of gear oil was spilled when a tugboat ran aground in Buzzards Bay near the mouth of the Cape Cod Canal. The tug Justice ran aground just after midnight Thursday. It has now been towed to the Massachusetts Maritime Academy and is no longer leaking oil. The Massachusetts unemployment rate dropped to 6.5% in February, down from 6.7% in January. This according to a report issued by the Executive Office of Labor and Workforce Development. The local economy created 500 jobs last month, with the largest gains coming in professional, scientific, and business services sector. The current national unemployment rate stands at 7.7%. And in Providence, the Senate Judiciary Committee meets today to review a gay marriage bill and a proposal to place the gay marriage issue on a ballot. The proposed referendum would allow religious leaders to refuse to perform same-sex weddings and says small businesses could decline to provide services for gay weddings. Support for NPR comes from Carbonite, providing automatic cloud backup to keep photos, music, and other files safe from computer mishaps. Details at carbonite.com. Weather for Boston, Worcester, and the Cape, cloudy with a slight chance of scattered snow showers this afternoon. Little or to no accumulation is expected. The high will be in the upper 30s. Right now it's 33 degrees in Boston. I'm Drew Dawson. For more news, visit WGBHnews.org.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH. Live, local talk. Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Missed you very much while I was gone, Jim.
Welcome back, Marjorie.
Thank you.
Even though Emily was quite great, I should
Hopa
say.
Hopa Mobilia.
Let me ask, on all serious note, you've been to an inauguration of a president in 2008.
Yes.
You were in D.C. You've been to the installation of a pope in 2013. You were in Rome, obviously. You
I
called
was.
In the other day. How do they compare?
In terms of people?
In terms of anything.
It was the biggest rush. I was on the subway in Rome getting to, not even the inaugural, but the blessing he gave at noontime. They had to have cops down in the subways keeping people from getting off like a stampede onto the subway tram to get to the Vatican. It was unbelievable. And I came within, I'd say, 25, 30 feet of the Pope Mobile.
Is that really true?
Yeah, I did. I saw him up there riding around, the new Pope, and waving to people.
And we should say this was serendipity. You were there on vacation visiting your kids.
Yes.
And it happened to be installation time. In any case, Marjorie is back. On page one of today's Globe is a story on a report showing 3 of 4 single mothers in Massachusetts don't make enough to raise their kids and pay their basic bills. That's according to the Crittenden's Women's Union. Joining us on the line to discuss that and other findings is Beth Babcock. She's the president and CEO of Crittenden. Beth, welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Marjorie. Nice to be with you.
Well, nice to be with you too, Beth. But this is tough stuff. Tell everybody what you found out.
Well, what we found out probably isn't news. You know, that it's that the cost of living in Massachusetts is going up faster than the wages are catching up, and it's making it harder and harder for working families to be able to cover their basic needs.
And how much do you need to cover your basic needs? If you're a single parent with a couple of kids, what kind of money are you talking about, Beth?
Well, across the state, if you are a family that has one adult, one preschooler, and one school-aged child, you need $65,880 in order to cover the basic needs for your family. This doesn't include dinners out or even saving for retirement or your kids' education. It also doesn't include paying off debt, which is a big problem that families now have trying to make ends meet.
Okay, so that's 65 grand. And what's the median income in the story for the average single mother? Somewhere below 30,000?
That's right. The median income, meaning half of women-headed families are below and above this figure, is $27,315. So we know that that women are having a very hard time supporting their families, but it isn't just women. It's families headed by men, and even two-parent families are having a hard time making ends meet.
So when the federal government does essentially what you're saying, what single mothers have to do, they borrow from China or some other place. What does that single mother do who's roughly 50% off what she needs for basics? What does she do?
Well, you know, she cuts corners. She cuts corners wherever she can. Maybe it's not, being able to provide heat. Maybe it's not being able to provide food. Maybe it's not being able to provide childcare. Maybe it's using credit cards to pay bills when you really don't want to. It's just a constant scramble to try to cover the basics of life.
And you know what I wonder, Beth, in these situations with single moms? Where's dad? Presumably, in many cases, people were divorced, and you would think he'd be on the hook for some money, or even if they were never married. Are fathers involved here, or are they just leaving all this financial burden to mom?
You know, the fathers are involved, but the fathers are also having problems making ends meet. I mean, a report by NPR just yesterday from the National Homeless Housing Coalition, showed that it would take three minimum wage jobs, in order to pay the monthly rent of a two-bedroom apartment in Boston. You know, so even when dads are involved, what you have is families who even with two earners oftentimes can't even cover the basic costs.
Well, you know, that's why this whole, I'm glad you brought this up, this whole debate about minimum wage. The Obama administration wants to raise the federal minimum wage to $9. Massachusetts is now $8, and I believe Senator Pacheco is trying to raise it to 10. Even if they're successful, and they're long shots because there's a lot of opposition, that doesn't come anywhere near the numbers that you suggest people need to live minimally basic, decent lives.
Yes. I mean, obviously, any increase in the minimum wage is helpful to low-income workers, but these proposals aren't going to get them there. I think what we know is that if the original minimum wage, when it was developed in the 1960s, were just ratcheted up by the actual cost of living to today, you know, the actual minimum wage would be above $16 an hour. So it hasn't begun to keep pace with what families need. But that being said, you know, what's driving all of this is that Massachusetts has a lot of great jobs, and Massachusetts is on the forefront of the knowledge-based economy. And families who make it into the knowledge-based jobs and the knowledge-based economy do well, and families who are left out of those jobs do not do well.
Okay, that's Deval Patrick's whole rap, as you've heard about community colleges and stuff like that, Beth Babcock, that there are, a couple of 100,000 jobs, and they're a far greater number than the people who are looking for work. So is the disconnect, the lack of educational abilities?
Yeah.
Is that it?
Yeah, exactly. The public policies and human service architecture that we're dealing with now to help people who are in poverty is based out of the war on poverty years, and our world has changed drastically since then. What we have now is we have working poor families who need to work and need to take care of their families. At the same time, they have to find a way to go to school to get additional training beyond high school in order to make it into the family-sustaining jobs. And the family-sustaining jobs are there. I mean, we developed and produced at the same time this mass index was released a hot jobs report that points out 15 job areas in the Massachusetts economy that can pay family-sustaining wages with just 2 years education beyond high school, and 50 jobs that pay a good chunk of the way, you know, get you up to $35,000 a year or more to support your family. But people don't know about how to get into these jobs, and they don't know how to train for them.
We're talking with Beth Babcock. She's the president and CEO of Crittenden Women's Union, and they just put out a new report. It's just startling. And one of the startling things is that the government programs you talked about that, you know, came into being mostly in the war of poverty, we used to think of those as for helping people that were not in the workforce. Now they're helping people that are in the workforce. If you guys are in this situation and are listening now to us, or if you have any ideas solution-wise to this terrible problem, call us at 877-301-8970 or email bpr@wgbh.org. Beth, so what are we supposed to do about this horrible situation? I mean, it is incredible when you have people in this Globe story today and what you've been finding going to food pantries and getting fuel assistance when they're two working mothers, whether it's mother and father's working in the house. It's just crazy.
Yeah. Well, you know, it used to be that the pathway out of poverty was getting a job. And if you had a job, you probably could take care of your family. You know, the old pathway out of poverty was Uncle Harry could get you in the union, you know, and those jobs paid
right.
Good family-sustaining wages. But now what we have to do is we have to help families take care of themselves, keep body and soul together, and somehow work and go to school at the same time, and go to school in the right places and get connected to the right jobs. And, you know, the extra costs for a working family of going to school are estimated to be around $20,000 a year to go to community college, because you have to have extra hours of childcare, you have to have the extra transportation to and from school. There are extra costs involved for people who are workers to actually get through schooling and get into these new knowledge-based jobs.
But, which is ultimately the vicious cycle. So there's this there's this $30,000 differential, and you add the cost of education to that, and it's unbelievable. Melissa is in South Grafton. You're on Boston Public Radio talking to Beth Babcock. Welcome, Melissa.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I'm calling because I'm actually one of the moms in the situation that you're discussing right now. I'm recently divorced. I have $235,000 in student loans from my two degrees, and I work at Starbucks.
Oh, Melissa.
I make $8.50 an hour. I have a six-year-old son, and I can't find an apartment. I don't make enough to get a two-bedroom apartment. I'm, like, trying to deal with, you know, just, like, the bureaucracy of, like, being on Section 8 waiting list and being a person with degrees and not able to find good work here. It's very frustrating.
How about
and
it, Beth?
I don't know what I'm going to do, you know?
Melissa, what kind of work are you looking for?
Well, initially, I mean, my first degree was in art history and library and information science.
Yeah.
My second degree was from Berklee College of Music. That's where I spent a lot of money. I did electronic production and sound design. And I was hoping to move into an industry like in Los Angeles or Massachusetts, or I mean New York City. But because of my divorce, I have to stay in Massachusetts. So I would be looking for, you know, audio work, sound design work. But I've had to reevaluate and say, well, what are my skills? I can do library. I can do. And I've just applied, you know, across the board. But it's been 6 months of nothing. So I'm at Starbucks now and just trying to make. You know, I'm terrified.
So hold up, Melissa, for a second. Beth, Melissa's doing exactly what you said she should be doing, and she's still working for $8.50 an hour.
Well, my heart goes out to you, and her story is unfortunately too common, because what happens is people get into and get their education focusing on the education itself and thinking if they get education, they're going to be able to get a good job. And, of course, the unemployment rates for individuals with a bachelor's degree and higher are one quarter the unemployment rates of people who have only a high school degree. So we know overall that's the recipe, but the degrees really do have to be in the right areas. In order to really give you a direct pipeline into jobs that pay a family-sustaining wage. So a art history degree, unfortunately, is not going to be one of those direct paths. And sound engineering and design is certainly closer to the technical kind of jobs that you look for today, but it's not actually one of the careers that's in high vacancy, high demand in Massachusetts. So we have to have families that actually start out their education, or women who start out their education, pointing toward the right kinds of jobs. And it's information that helps people make those decisions. Now, we do a lot of work with people who have educational debt and try to help them get their debt put in payment programs or in abeyance or find ways to restructure their debt so that they can actually move ahead and get into the careers.
How can people like Melissa who have, I mean, that's another topic for another, the obscenity of $250,000 education debt.
Yeah.
How does Melissa and people like Melissa get that help, Beth Babcock?
Well, she connects with organizations like mine that provide how? Call, email.
What is your email? What's your phone number?
Our website is www.liveworkthrive.org. She can speak to people in our Woman to Woman program,
great,
which is the first step toward getting into that kind of help you need.
Hey, Melissa, wonderful. Good luck, and stay in touch with us and let us know how it goes. That's really, you know, the whole, we hadn't talked about
a damper on the old liberal arts education but that is, idea, doesn't it? I mean, does it?
As I said, the overall stats are great. If you have a bachelor's degree or higher, you're more likely to be working, and you're more likely to be having a family-sustaining job. There's just no question. But there are those who, unfortunately, you know, are still looking for work, and you have to get the training in the areas where there's the demand for workers.
We're talking with Beth Babcock from the Crittenden Women's Union. You know, one of the most disturbing anecdotes to me in this story that was in the Globe this morning, Beth, is that there was a young woman from Smith College, graduate there, good college. She's getting $27,000 a year as a full-time staff writer in a newspaper. She's trying to raise two teenage sons alone. She's having to rely on subsidized housing and fuel assistance and food pantries to do it. And here she is, a graduate of one of the finest colleges in Massachusetts.
I know. What this really points out is, first of all, how much it really does take to support your family. And those numbers are just, you can't ignore them. Rent costs what rent costs. You know, heat costs what heat costs. Those are hard numbers. And it points that out, and it also points out the fact that, you know, the jobs that you want to be training for, the jobs you want to be looking at, if you are a person who has to support a family, are those jobs that pay those families sustaining wages. And they really are there, but it's the new economy, you know. The road markers into the new economy are just being built now, and people have to follow the new signs. I hope this report is one of the ways they can find
the
new road markers.
Put this in context, Beth Bobke. The other piece in the story, not from you, but from the Center for Law and Social Policy, I was stunned by this, too. In Massachusetts, the gap between rich and poor is among the largest in the United States of America. It says the state's poverty rate is below the national average, but when you factor in things like you mentioned, housing, et cetera, regional living expenses, we're 10th highest. Margaret in Boston, you are next on Boston Public Radio with Beth Babcock. Welcome, Margaret.
Good afternoon. Greetings to Beth, my partner in crime. I'm with the Midas Collaborative, which is a network
Margaret,
of nonprofit organizations across the state. I'm saluting you, Beth, for this important work and certainly affirming that we're seeing this across the state. We're seeing a big generational divide with young people coming out of college who are facing these incredible numbers. So this is going on. A few suggestions I had were focus on the middle skill jobs that the governor and some of the community colleges are starting to focus on, because there are some jobs out there for folks with middle skills that don't need a lot of higher education. Certainly increase the minimum wage to the living wage. This is going on nationally. Let's not forget, these are Fortune 500 companies in many cases that are making huge profits on Wall Street, and they are paying their workers not enough to survive.
But Margaret, before you go ahead, for those who don't know, living wage, when calculated, meaning what it costs to live in a particular community, which is significantly higher than minimum wage, other than isolated cities, bastions of progressivism, for lack of a better expression, around the country, living wage has gone virtually nowhere, has it?
Absolutely.
Well, meaning I'm right. So as a practical, that's really what I want to ask both of you, Margaret and Beth. It seems to me, even though single mothers vote, I would assume, in relatively decent numbers, there was virtually silence when Deval Patrick suggested, I think he suggested, that we eliminate tuition at community colleges, which would go a long way towards beginning to solve this problem. So who cares about this other than you two and the single mothers themselves? Beth first.
Oh, I think Dan O'Connell, head of the Massachusetts Workforce Competitiveness Council, which represents the 15 CEOs of the 15 largest corporations in America, Dan O'Connell cares about this and spoke to it this morning at the State House with us. I think we have a lot of business leaders who are aware of the fact that this is the way to create a healthier economy for Massachusetts, is to support this kind of pathways to training and supporting working poor families to get the access to the education they need.
And how about you, Margaret? 2 cents on that issue?
Well, I absolutely agree, and I also want to point out that there's a bill in front of the state Senate right now to increase the earned income tax credit for low-wage workers that's sponsored by Senator Cynthia Cream, which is an immediate relief for folks who are not getting paid enough. It is proportionate to the federal earned income tax credit, which is basically tax credits for work.
We should explain, for people who don't know what that means in English, I used to work on one of those campaigns. That's an actual refundable tax credit, which means in English, low-income people who qualify can get a check from the government as much as several thousand dollars, which is huge, but a huge number of people don't know about it either. So I'm really glad you brought it up. The EITC, Earned Income Tax Credit.
Margaret, thank you very much for calling. And Beth, thank you so much for being with us. And by the way, Beth Babcock, President of CEO of Crittenden and Women's Union, tell people your website again in case they want to get in touch with you and the information you can offer them.
Oh, thank you very much, Marjorie. It's www.liveworkthrive.org.
Beth, thank you so much for being with us. And like I said, that was tough stuff.
So many people are struggling. We have the 10th largest gap between rich and poor in Massachusetts.
Okay.
I mean, it's stunning.
Sublime to the ridiculous is the wrong phrase. But we're moving on in any case to talk about the best way to say I'm sorry because of a recent incident here in Massachusetts. Do you just say I'm sorry? My bad? Mea culpa? Mistakes were made? Are these just for damage control or true, sincere expressions of regret? That conversation is next on Boston Public Radio.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and Marjorie Egan has returned from her short trip to Rome. Welcome back, Marjorie.
Thank you.
A couple of days ago, you missed this, actually, Marjorie, at a St. Patrick's Day breakfast, the sheriff of Plymouth County, this guy Joe McDonald Jr., attempted a joke. He later called it political satire. Here it is.
Obama's looking at Abraham Lincoln adoringly, and he says, "President Lincoln, please share your wisdom with me. What can I do to make this country a better place?" And Lincoln looks him in the eye, and he says, "Go to the theater."
Well, he told an assassination joke, and it apparently got a lot of laughter from what we hear in the background. The next day, Joe McDonald's position was, hey, it's political satire. It's no big deal. People made jokes about how George W. Bush should go hunting with Dick Cheney after Cheney, remember this, shot his friend in the face when they were hunting. Well, when the pressure continued to mount and it started to get threats, Sheriff McDonald decided it was time to do more. He's speaking with the reporters. Here's what he said, I guess, 2 days later.
I spoke off the cuff at this event, and I made a joke. In retrospect, apparently a joke that many people found to be offensive. At the time, I didn't see a problem with it because the same joke has been told for about the last 150 years. Sure, I can see if you see that in a vacuum, and I think that can be problematic. And again, you know, if that's the case, I'm sorry about that.
If that's the case, I am sorry about that. Margie and I have talked a lot about apologies through the years, and generally one has a sense. You know that old line Potter Stewart, I think, on the Supreme Court said,
uh-huh.
I can't define obscenity, but yeah. I know it when I see it. Well, I think I speak for Margie when I say, I can't define a sincere apology, but you know it when you see it. When someone says something, at least to me, when someone says, well, if you took it that way, or if I offended anybody, you know that that's the beginning, at least in our estimation, of an insincere apology. So this all raises questions we face so often in American life. When is an apology really an apology or simply damage control, and Marjorie said? And if you receive a sincere apology, does it cause you to forgive? Give us a buzz, 877-301-8970.
Okay. So which category would you say the sheriff's apology?
Well, I just said it was totally insincere.
Insincere.
What I can't remember his exact words, but in that context, if you took it that
way.
Been
told for 150 years. I don't think I've heard that joke for 150 years or even for 2 years. Have you heard that joke before?
Well, you know, I'm embarrassed to say I actually have heard the joke before. And
but
I did hear
theater?
The Bush jokes. Yeah, variation on that theme. But as many people have commented on this, he's not just a public official, which in my opinion is bad enough. He's a sheriff. He's a law enforcement official. And making an assassination joke.
In general.
It just is not good form.
I think that's correct. I think generally speaking, assassination jokes are not the way to go in sort of a humorous vein. And there's the other issue, too. I mean, I think a lot of people, because Obama's the first African-American president, the first biracial president. Anyway, you think to yourself, I remember when we were up in New Hampshire covering the primary, the first time around when he got up on the stage. I mean, people who excite strong emotions in people are often the people that get people that are a little off the rails, all riled up. And I remember thinking when he first spoke in New Hampshire and people were just ecstatic to see him in a cheering crowd. It scared me to death. I thought, I was scared for Barack Obama. Now, this is 6 years later. I feel a little bit better about it now, but I think there's the added aspect of his being the first black president.
877-301-8970. How do you tell the difference between a sincere apology or a damage control apology? Here's an example, at least in my estimation. Marjorie hasn't heard this yet. You'll remember, you may not remember, Richard Murdoch was the Republican Senate candidate. He ran against Claire McCaskill out there in Indiana in the last cycle. He's the one who said, if you get pregnant from rape, it's God's will. And when he took a little bit of a blowback from that, here's what Murdoch had to say.
I believe rape is a brutal act. It is something that I abhor, and that anyone could come away with any meaning other than what I just said is regrettable, and for that, I apologize.
Now, this is one of the best ever.
Oh, yeah.
He attacks the listener, saying,
that's right.
If anybody could be stupid enough to actually believe what I said, which was that a pregnancy from rape is God's will, well, that's regrettable that you're that stupid, and if you're that stupid, I apologize to you. I mean, that is the quintessential non-apology apology.
He was a real creep, let's face it. Was he not a real creep? But it was a good thing for the Democrats, because I think Republicans helped Barack Obama because of ridiculous remarks made by guys like Richard Murdoch.
Don't you find, though, with the second point that I made a few minutes ago, and by the way, our number is 877-301-8970, give us an example of what you consider to be a sincere apology that won you over or one that didn't. As angry as I am at politicians, at athletes, when they are looking into a camera or you hear their voice and you get the sense that it's really heartfelt. It's not a CYA kind
well,
of thing.
To say
aren't you
something?
Willing to? Aren't you yes. willing to say I'm willing to give this
you're
guy or woman
to
a break?
Say it's totally my fault. I totally screwed up. There's no one to blame but me here. And you kind of get down on your knees and beg for forgiveness. I mean, I think those, you can
it
tell.
It works.
Well, it does work because everybody screws up. I mean, I know you, Jimmy, have not screwed up as much as the average
no, of course not.
Mortal, but some of us, I screw up on a regular basis and I find myself apologizing almost nonstop.
And by the way, there are often second acts in American life for those who do give what appear to be sincere apologies. We're going to play some sound from some of them in a minute. But first, let's take a couple of phone calls. Bill, you're on the Cape and you're on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about the art of the apology. She's Marjorie Egan and I'm Jim Browdy. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Jim, Marjorie.
Hi.
Welcome to your new venue.
Well, thank you kindly. We're very happy here.
Down here in the Cape, we're happy to hear you guys again because when you're on the old station, we couldn't get you.
Yeah.
And,
that's why we moved, Bill.
Big signal here. Big signal on 89.7.
Yeah, it is. You guys, look, I think it's 50,000 watts or whatever.
But I think it's 100, actually. But what do you think about Sheriff McDonald, Bill?
I didn't hear it in its original form. In fact, I didn't. When you played the tape of his joke, I actually, because of the quality of the tape, I guess, I really couldn't catch all the punchline. I think I know what he said, but...
Well, Bill, stop right there. Stop. Before you continue, because you were so kind to us, we'll play it again. Here is Joe McDonald Jr. He's the sheriff of Plymouth County at the St. Patrick's Day breakfast. Here it is.
Obama's looking at Abraham Lincoln adoringly, and he says, President Lincoln, please share your wisdom with me. What can I do to make this country a better place? And Lincoln looks him in the eye, and he says, go to the theater.
So there you go, Joe. Bill, what's your take?
Yeah, I think he's right about the fact that that joke or versions of that joke, you know, Mrs. Lincoln, what did you think of the play kind of thing and all that stuff. I think that's been told for a long time. I think we are, because Barack Obama is a black man, and this country is still very thoroughly divided along racial lines. I think that's why the joke is out of bounds, because we haven't dealt with the core issue in the way that we might have when it comes to race relations.
Yeah,
I think that's
bomb. We're always going to have the race conversation, Bill, and we never quite do. But what did you think of the apology, though, from the sheriff? I thought it was a pure – I thought it was a picture of insincerity. What did you think?
I'd give him maybe a B+. there was some damage control. There's no question about that. And
Bill, if he had just said, as Marjorie said a minute ago, in brief, you know what? I really screwed up. I shouldn't have done it.
Yeah, I wasn't
and I
thinking.
Apologize. Wouldn't have you said, there's a grown-up, there's an adult, and you move on? That's at least that would have been my take.
Listen, I agree with you 100%. I watched an interview with Lanny Davis yesterday on the book that he's just brought out.
Yep.
And he was very close to Bill Clinton during that Lewinsky thing. And it was very clear that Lanny Davis' advice to Clinton in those days was, I'm not going to tell you as a lawyer. I'm going to tell you as a friend. Get it out there. And of course, that was during the period when the famous blue dress wasn't known to exist.
Yeah, but in all fairness, Bill, Lanny Davis is a little full of himself. I'm not sure if that's revisionist history either. But, Bill, thank you kindly for your greeting and for your call. We appreciate it.
But you know what? I mean, here we are on the radio. I mean, how many times have you said things without really thinking that were just they were a bad joke or inappropriate remark? I mean, I've done it many times, and you feel...
I can't remember ever having done
yeah,
it.
Yeah, well, I have. And the moment it comes out of your mouth, you think, I should never have said that. So you have to sort of apologize right away, because I don't think that the sheriff intended, you know, to make a bad assassination joke with racial overtones. I think he just wasn't thinking. So you say that. You know something? I just wasn't thinking. It came out of my mouth. It was stupid. It was dumb. I wish I could take it back. That makes you feel better about the guy.
Let's share some apologies with you. First, you're going to hear Bill Clinton. Then you're going to hear Anthony Weiner. Remember him?
Oh,
I mean,
my God.
Think of the name, and then you'll remember in a minute. And we may get to a guy who's the former governor of South Carolina, who is now, as of Tuesday, the Republican nominee from South Carolina for a seat in Congress against Stephen Colbert's sister. Listen up.
It is important to me that everybody who has been hurt know that the sorrow I feel is genuine.
I brought pain to people I care about the most, the people who believed in me. And for that, I'm deeply sorry. I apologize to my wife and our families. as well as to our friends and supporters. I'm deeply ashamed of my terrible judgment and actions.
I hurt her. I hurt you all. I hurt my wife. I hurt my boys. I hurt friends like Tom Davis. I hurt a lot of different folks. And all I can say is that I apologize.
I apologize first and most importantly to my family. I apologize to the public.
It's Elliot Spitzer. I can't listen to Elliot Spitzer. But think about the impact here.
Oh, no. I wish we could bring him back because he's the only one that went after Wall Street.
Bill Clinton is the single most popular politician in America right now, if not his wife. Anthony Weiner is now raising money to run for office again. We don't know what's going to happen. And Sanford, as I said, former governor, leaves in disgrace because of the Appalachian Trail or wherever he said he was when he was actually in South America, now is the Republican nominee, the comeback kid. And I think there's a message in that, which is if you apologize, and all three of those sounded totally sincere, whether they were or not. Would you not? Would you not agree?
I thought Sanford's was pretty good.
Weiner was crying. Weiner, well, you think he's a phony?
Jim, if people don't remember, Weiner sent out pictures of himself.
Yes, he did.
From the gym in various stages of undress at the time that his wife was pregnant.
He can't be sincere. I'm not defending his underlying behavior.
I don't
nor
think it matters
nor...
how many times Congressman Weiner apologizes, especially since he's named Congressman Weiner.
Thank you.
Can you have a big political career after, you know what I'm saying?
I think let's leave it there. Paul, you're in Milton. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Paul.
Hey, Jim, Marjorie, always great to hear you.
Oh, Paul, it's great to hear your voice,
Paul.
Too. Welcome.
Good. Well, you know, there is life after
life.
Not so great a meteor, but that's okay.
We loved it there, but thank you, Paul.
Thanks. All right. What bothered me about what you just played, and if you play it again, it's not the joke. It's the people behind him who are laughing.
You mean Sheriff McDonald? They're laughing wildly.
Whatever.
Wildly, yeah.
And Jim was there. Jim was there.
No, this is a different St. Patrick's Day breakfast. Okay. Good, Paul. I'm sorry. No, yeah. You're right.
There were
two St. Patrick's Day breakfasts. This was not the one that was in South Boston where
I
was.
I'm sorry.
But it was a different one on the same day. Go ahead, Paul.
This was in Scituate, I believe.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And a Republican fest for St. Patrick's Day?
Yeah, but in fairness, Paul, I know where you're going. The thing in South Boston was the Democratic fest. With the exception of Bill Weld, it was all Democrats all the time.
Right. Yeah, of course. But nonetheless, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, happen to be Republicans this time. But just listening to the roar of laughter that comes out of these people after he tells this joke that is, I don't care if it goes back to Methuselah. You know, it's just inappropriate. And if this sheriff didn't have the brains to understand that and censor himself and review it, maybe talk to somebody before he gave the joke. I just think it speaks volumes about him. But again, more about the people in the background who are laughing at
him. Hey, Paul, can I ask you? Am I allowed to say on the air? Would you? Can I say who your former boss was?
Yeah, sure, of course.
Paul used to be a producer for the Dean of Talk Radio, one of the greatest talk radio hosts of all time, Jerry Williams. Did Jerry Williams ever apologize on the air for anything?
I guess the question is, did he need to?
Well, he came pretty close to the edge more than once, did he not?
Yeah, I guess he did, obviously. And I'm not sure that he came close to the edge when I was there. Probably the worst thing that happened to him when I was there is he conducted the first Cosmopolitan sex survey.
We remember it well, yes. And I'm sure he was never going to apologize for that, right?
No, absolutely not.
I didn't think so.
It was a bit of pandemonium on the other side of the glass, I can tell you, fending off calls.
Well, also, it was a ratings bonanza, whether people thought it was tasteless or not.
Yeah.
Hey, Paul, we got to go. Paul, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Let's go to Salem, Massachusetts, where Kathy is on with Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan on Boston Public Radio. Welcome, Kathy.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thank you. So good to hear you back on the air again.
Thanks for calling.
you're welcome. This is a lighthearted personal experience with an apology. I was driving around looking for a parking space, saw one and pulled into it, and a woman who was two rows over came up behind me and said, "You took my parking spot." And I said, "I did?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "I'm very sorry, I'll move my car." And she said, no, that's okay, you don't have to. It was ironic that I think she was prepared for a fight, but I did indeed move my car, and then she apologized, and the two of us walked into the store together.
That is actually a great story.
Well, Kathy, but isn't that true in general? If someone, even a friend or a family member, does something bad and they come up and apologize to you, then and they're sincere, then it brings you closer, doesn't it? I think so. It does.
Yeah.
So that's a great.
I agree.
Yeah.
I think my own personal feeling is that kids, for the most part, I'm not sure, are taught either by example or verbally taught to own up to their shortcomings and their mistakes. I know that when I was raising my daughter, who's now 24, I wouldn't accept sorry. It would have to be a complete sentence. What exactly is it you're sorry for?
That's great.
I want the whole sentence.
And are you sorry for what you did, or are you sorry that you got caught? That's always the question, too.
Exactly.
Well, yeah. Thank you for the call, Kathy.
Thanks. That's a great story.
Oh, I think that was the Mark Sanford thing, when he apologized for being not on the Appalachian Trail and actually off with, what did they call her, the Argentinian firecracker, or something like that. Maybe she knew the Pope. I don't know.
No, the Argentinian firecracker, I think, was the woman, the dancer who was messing around with the former Speaker of the House a couple of decades ago. She was another firecracker. Let's take one more on apologies. Dave, you're in Shrewsbury with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Dave.
Hey there. I guess if you have to caveat your apology, then it's probably not too sincere.
Amen. Amen. That's the key.
Okay. I guess that's a good place to end.
He's
it.
Totally right. If you say, I apologize to anybody who may have been offended
I
said, you shouldn't bother apologizing.
Investigate during the break, please, who the Argentinian firecracker
is.
Was that Fanny Fox?
Fanny Fox. That's
Fanny
exactly
Fox?
Who it was. Yes.
I forget. There are so many firecrackers and so little time. Okay. This is Boston Public Radio. The Shake Shack made its debut in Boston yesterday. People waited for hours to try the franchise fare. Joining us in the studio. Am I supposed to be saying this? You're supposed to be saying this.
No, you're supposed to be saying this. Yes.
We're going to find out how the Shake Burger stacks up against other burgers around town. Which is the best burger in Boston? We'll find out.
The new film Olympus Has Fallen has a terrifying premise. A terrorist attack on the White House, a captured president. What could be more fun than that, says director Antoine Fuqua.
Take the audience on a roller coaster ride. You know, why not? It has everything in it that a filmmaker would want.
We speak with him and one of the film's many stars, Angela Bassett, next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the Harvard Innovation Lab, where entrepreneurs from across Harvard, the Austin community, Boston, and beyond engage in teaching and learning in pursuit of taking their innovative ideas to the world. ilab.harvard.edu. And New England Audi dealers, presenting the full line of Audi luxury performance sedans, SUV crossovers, coupes, and convertibles, all with quattro all-wheel drive. You can learn more at newenglandaudidealers.com.
I'm Jim Browdy, she's Marjorie, and you're listening to Boston Public Radio. They lined up for hours yesterday in Chestnut Hill. It wasn't an Apple store or for some movie premiere, but for a hamburger. Some actually think it's the hamburger. Shake Shack finally comes to Boston. Joining us to say whether Michelle Obama's fave falls in the pantheon of best burgers is a guy who owns a professional chef and catering business in town. It's called The Skinny Beet. And he's the man behind BostonBurgerBlog.com. Richard Chutty, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you have burger socks,
yes.
You have a burger wallet, and you have a White Castle t-shirt.
I'm off to a good start, yeah.
So tell us, is this like the best burger around?
It's in the conversation, I think.
In the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I think for that style that it is, which is sort of a fast food, fast casual kind of style, I think it's probably the best. Are definitely one of the better versions that we have right now. If you want to compare it to, you know, You Burger and Tasty Burger and, you know, Five Guys, I think it's, you know, phenomenally better than those.
It is?
I think so.
But
yeah,
why?
Sure.
What's the essence of the burger at Shake Shack? We all know the
you
story of Michelle Obama going there and I guess eating, what was it, 1,700 calories. It was later amended down to 1,560. She said, I sometimes deserve a break. Describe the Shake Shack burger to us, Richard.
Yeah, I mean, for lack of a better phrase, it's all about the meat. And like most most burgers, especially of the fast food, fast casual style, kind of miss the mark on the beef, which to me is the most important component of the burger. So I think Shake Shack really is, it's the best tasting beef of a burger of that kind of price point that I've ever had.
Can you get like a one that's pink in the middle, or are they all going to be well done all the way through?
I think they cook them sort of well all the way through. Yeah, but for that style, the griddled kind of thin patty, it works.
Now, do we have like a secret sauce with lettuce and tomatoes, or is it just the plain old burger with the cheese if you want it and the bun?
Yeah, I mean, it's very classic. I have the shake sauce, which is basically a mayonnaise-based kind of Thousand Islands sort of style thing. And you get lettuce and tomato and the very classic Martin's potato roll, which is one of the better buns you can have. So,
can you just order a side of the sauce and forget the burger?
You can, yeah.
We're talking to Richard Shuddy, who is the guy behind BostonBurgerBlog.com. Now, Richard said of its genre, it's the best, but you're not exultant about it. Listen to this guy in the Boston Globe a couple days ago, a piece by the great Christopher Muther. This is a guy, Benjamin Hockman, who's a sports writer. Quote, to put it in Boston terms, you can compare this burger to Pedro Martinez's 99 season. Compared to the 86 Celtics, say it's akin to Ted Williams' 400 batting average. Simply put, it's the Kate Upton of cheeseburgers. You know, the sense I get of this after talking to you, it's in part the scene, is it not? I mean, years ago, I don't know if you were around for this, what was the name of the donut that came up from the South that was supposed to be the
Krispy Kreme.
Krispy Kreme. Everybody said was going to blow away Dunkin' Donuts. It opened in, was it Malden or one of the M towns?
I forget.
Medford. It opened in Medford. I went there. Mm-hmm. The line was all the way down Route 16. And what? In a matter of a year or 2 years, they were all gone.
Nothing. It was such a disappointment. I was so excited about these Krispy Kreme donuts because I love
donuts.
They
were so good, and they're gone.
I thought they were so good, but they were only so good when they were hot.
Right, true.
And so putting it in the microwave just wasn't quite the same kind of thing. And Krispy Kreme, is it even here anymore?
Well, not here anymore. But that's my question. Is this the Krispy Kreme of hamburgers, or does this have staying power?
I think it has staying power. But yeah, to your point, I mean, the hype built around this already is just, it's been outrageous. And, you know, you compared it to, you know, waiting in line for a movie and stuff like that. I think it's similar. Why, you know, we're waiting in line for a hamburger. It's a little silly. It's a very good hamburger. I don't know if it's worth waiting in line for, but I think it has staying power, yeah.
Marjorie and I went online. The first thing we did this morning was find out what time it's open in Chestnut. It's open
until 11 o'clock.
We'll be there. So at 877-301-8970, if you've ever had a Shake Shack burger, give us your review. And we're going to ask Richard in a second. We want to ask you, too, what is the best burger in Boston? 877-301-8970. So rank the top three for me, burger
sure
guy.
It's funny, I actually just started doing sort of a burger bracket, kind of a la the burger NCAA
brackets.
Tournament, just based on my rankings and popularity, and kind of see, we're only in the second round right now, but for me, J.M. Curley, Craigie on Main, and then some sort of combination of maybe the Gallows or Back Bay Social Club probably have the better burger.
Wait a minute,
I've only had one of the three.
Uh-oh,
Craigie on Main is spectacular. So what is it? You said the meat before.
Yeah.
Is it the quality of the meat that makes, or it's the stuff that comes
around it? It's the whole package,
it?
But the quality of the meat definitely makes a difference.
Now, you interestingly did not mention a place where I live near this place. Mm-hmm. There is always a line, sometimes tour buses in Harvard Square, Bartley's Burgers. I mean, there is almost never a time you can get in that place. Didn't make your top three. Does it make your top 10?
No, it doesn't make my top 10. It's great. It's iconic. It's, you know, worth a visit. It's good for what it is. But I think, again, there's better places. I think Boston's funny that way. It's become this place where, like, the better burgers, in my opinion at least, are sort of at the higher end restaurants, maybe a slightly higher price point. And I think people really crave, you know, the Shake Shack, the cheaper ones, the more affordable ones, because that's what they're used to.
Well, I remember going to lunch one time at the La Di Da Four Seasons Bristol Lounge, and I think they had a burger for about $18, which is a lot of money for burger. But boy, it is a great burger because you can say I want it medium or medium rare,
exactly.
And you don't feel like, I am always suspicious of a lot of the meat. You know what I'm saying?
Definitely. Yeah.
You wonder, what am I really eating here? And I can't enjoy. Now, when you go to the Shake Shack, mm-hmm. do you feel suspicious about the meat, or do you feel like you can bite right
definitely
in?
Definitely not. They use Pat LaFrieda beef, which is, you know, one of the better meat suppliers in the
good.
Country. So, yeah.
Okay, that's
you know,
good.
You can feel good about it.
Now,
yeah.
you're interested. Before we get to the calls, we'll do that in a second at 877-301-8970. What do you think of the Shake Shack burger if you've had one? And if you haven't, are you going to start standing in line? And what's the best burger in town? You're wearing a White Castle T-shirt.
Yeah.
Are they still square burgers? Is that the deal?
They are, yeah.
My experience, Marjorie knows this story, many, many years ago, there's a White White Castle in Central Square in Cambridge. And I went there and I got in a bit of an argument. This is a true story with a guy who was serving the burgers and they were 99 cents. And I ordered two burgers. Uh-huh. So it's two times 99 cents. We almost got in a fight over something that I won't get into. And as I take the burgers angrily, I leave. I don't leave a tip. As I bite into one of the burgers, there's something hard inside of it. And what he had done is put my penny change in each of the two. That's not a typical behavior at White Castle, is it? Or is it?
That's pretty normal, I think. It's pretty
normal. Okay, fine. Let's go to Michael in Hull. We're talking Shake Shack and burgers in general. Good morning or good afternoon, Michael. Hi.
Good afternoon.
Hey.
So what's the name of the place?
Shake Shack.
Right, and it's worth going. I saw Michelle Obama there standing in line just to get a shake. Went to the one in Times Square, the Fair Market coffee shake, the vanilla shake, the peanut butter shake. They're unbelievable. Never even had a burger.
Well, so they got the custard. I'm glad you brought that up because the shakes are supposed to be great. Did you have the custard? The custard's supposed to be great there, too.
Yeah.
Never got by the shakes, but I'll stand in line 2 hours to get one of those.
Was there a line in the Times Square, Michael?
Times Square, when they first opened, I was there, and there were spotlights. Everybody just came to see what was going on. That whole weekend, you couldn't get near the place. I couldn't get it. Went back a year later. There was still a line. Year later, it's still mobbed. So does it have staying power? You bet.
You're my kind of guy, Michael. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
Have you actually been inside a Shake Shack, Chris? You've been there, right?
Richard, too.
Richard, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
Chris
was... in New York, not just on Hill yet.
So
yeah.
Tell me about the salvage bowling alley wood for the tabletops. I mean, this is like a big thing, the interior design. The
interior's nice. Yeah, it looks like a lot of the sort of modern... sort of upscale pubs that we have now in Boston.
So that's a big thing.
It is a big thing, yeah.
I mean, you don't really... The design inside of McDonald's or Burger King is not...
It's a little uninspiring, yeah. A lot of them just look like this retro 50s kind of diner thing, but Shake Shack's a little
more
elevated.
And there's beer and wine. So that's a big thing, too, right?
I mean, there's beer and wine in the Shake Shack?
Yes.
That's really dangerous, actually. Let's go to Sharon in Marblehead. You're on with Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, and Richard Chuddy. He's the guy behind BostonBurgerBlog.com. Hey, Sharon.
Hi, I just wanted to call in and place my vote for When Pigs Fly. They have the best burger I've ever had.
Where's this? I didn't know they'd made burgers.
So those just bread.
No, they make the bread right there, and they have a tasting room, and you can go in and sample as much as you want. They're very generous with their samples, and they make all kinds of delicious breads and desserts and cookies. Well, it is in Kittery, Maine, and I'm looking at my receipt because I was just there last week. It's 447 Main Street, U.S. Route 1 in Kittery, Maine, and it's great.
Sounds great.
And it's a quick ride. Yeah, well, from Marblehead, it's a quick ride, like an hour, a little over an hour.
Well, also, if one assumes, as I do, I don't know how you feel about this, Richard, and thanks for the call, Sharon, that bread is a critical piece. The roll or whatever it's on is a critical component of the whole burger experience. When Pigs Fly makes great bread.
Yeah, that's the one in Brookline.
There's one in Davis Square, too. Yeah, in Somerville.
Somerville. But there's no cheeseburgers at the
moment. You ever had that one or no?
I have not, no.
How did you get involved in the burger? I mean, your parents say, I'm so proud my kid grew up to be a burger blogger. How did you end up in the business?
I don't know. I finished culinary school a few years ago, and I've always had this.
Oh, you're a chef.
I'm a chef. Yeah, my fiance and I own the catering company, which is Skinny Beat. And I don't know. I just always had this love of burgers, and I thought it'd be interesting to kind of, you know, go around Boston and try all the different ones and kind of just be candid about it and write what I, you know, found. So
do you find odd that the name of your catering business is the Skinny Beat and you've got
ironic,
a burger blog?
I mean, it's a little strange. The story with that, where my fiance and I are both Polish, and my last name in Polish translates to skinny, basically, and
it
her
does?
Last name translates to
beet?
Beet soup. So we dropped the soup and we're the Skinny Beet.
That's pretty good, actually. Never would have guessed.
So Craigie on Main is another not cheap restaurant. That's in Cambridge.
Yeah.
But their burgers, again, would be like $15.
I think it's 17, 18. And Craigie's great, but like it's so hard to get. They only, I think they sell like 20 a night. You have to make a reservation, which is absurd for a burger.
You do?
You do.
So what, you call in and say, I'd like to reserve a cheeseburger, is what you say?
Yeah, it's off menu now. They can only serve it in the bar area. It's so pretentious, but it's delicious. But they have it for brunch too, which is a little more accessible.
Because they think that the burger is too low scale for their atmosphere?
Yeah, I mean, it's very fine dining, and I think the chef probably didn't want to be known for a burger. one way or another. But he's opening a new place in Somerville that I think will be a little more casual.
Well, you also don't want people in a higher cost restaurant to be ordering one of the lowest cost items on the menu, right?
Exactly.
Let's. Our number is 877-301. We're in an 897. I'm sorry, 877-301-8970. We're in a search for the best burger in Boston. We're asking whether the Shake Shack has it. Rhonda, you're in a car and you're on with Richard Chutty and Jim Browdy and Marjorie again. Hey, Rhonda.
Good morning or good afternoon.
Hi.
I'm calling just to say, well, I'm not a big burger fan because they're not too good for me, but I do splurge once a year on a burger and I make sure I get it someplace good, not at a fast food place. But I'm really calling regarding Krispy Kreme just to tell you what happened to them.
Yeah.
I went to New York and tried Krispy Kreme because Rosie O'Donnell was promoting them when she had her talk show, mm-hmm. and they were to die for. So I went back, came back to Massachusetts, and I couldn't wait for them to come here. And after they opened that first shop in wherever you said the M word, and they were doing pretty well, and I know out in the burbs where I was at the time, Hopedale, the schools were doing fundraisers, getting boxes of Krispy Kreme donuts, and it was becoming a really big thing. And then 9/11 came. But just before 9/11, I said, you know, they tell you when you're going to invest in the stock market to buy what you know. So I bought some Krispy Kreme stock because I dislike Dunkin' Donuts. I don't know why Krispy Kreme isn't here instead. But I bought some stock, made some money, and then 9/11 came, and Krispy Kreme just got caught in the middle of expansion after 9/11, and I think that that's why they didn't make it here.
Are they exist elsewhere now in the South? Do they not?
They're still elsewhere, right?
Yeah.
Hey, Rhonda, thanks for the call.
I don't think they were as good as Dunkin' Donuts myself. I'd be absolutely.
Well, they were light as a feather. They were odd.
Yeah, they were airy. It was the glazed donuts.
Like you said, when they're hot, they were delicious.
They were hot, but they sort of just kind of, well, I guess melting your mouth sounds pretty good, but they melted too quickly in your mouth. I think that was one of the problems. Richard, I want to know because you are you're a chef. You've got the catering business, the Skinny Beat, and of course the Burger Blog. You know, I just had a sandwich before we came down here, and I've been talking to you for 10 minutes, and I'm starving. And how do you – I mean, if you're the burger blogger, aren't you, like, starving all the time?
It's tough. It's a balance. We try to, you know, exercise cooking for other people at home. I think we really try to maintain, like, very, you know, low-fat, low-calorie, and just – eat very well at home, a lot of whole grains.
Yeah.
We try to limit going out to maybe once a week or so.
Well, that's a good question. Is there such a thing? Is there a burger in town? Two questions, I guess. One, is there a comparatively low-fat, low-calorie burger that's edible in Boston?
I don't like the low-fat ones. I mean, I feel like if you're going to eat a burger, eat a burger.
What,
you know what I mean?
A low-fat burger.
Well, you go with 90% beef, 10% fat.
That's a great question, actually.
Yeah.
When you go to buy the beef for the burgers, you really do have to get the pretty fatty
beef,
don't you?
Fattest flavor. So
like, what, 80%?
80 would be ideal.
80 would be ideal. I know what you're talking about, Jim.
I prefer the 50-50 myself. Now, another question. This is more common. How about low-end burger choices? You mentioned that apparently, according to this Globe story, and from what you said, the Shake Shack is not that expensive. Apparently, the basic is under $5, which is pretty affordable. What else is in the low-end category for people who can't afford a Craigie on Main Burger or something like that?
I always like Flat Patties, which is in Harvard Square. Not super local, but Bobby Flay just opened a place in Burlington that I really like. That's very affordable, too. So those two, I would say, stand out.
And what, when you say low-end, what's that, $5, $6, something like that?
Yeah, I mean, the basic like burger starting about $6 or so. If you can get the classic combo for under 10, I feel like that's very good value.
Yeah, I'm sort of disappointed you didn't bring us any burgers.
You should have asked. I would have.
Believe me.
Why don't you ask?
We just assumed
to get
you'd
a couple
them.
Of burgers. You know what I'm saying? Just take a bite right now, and you want them to be juicy and messy, and so you have to have about 5 napkins.
Exactly.
Marjorie,
yeah.
I'm going to be seeing you at 10:45 at the Shake Shack in Chestnut Hill. Let's go to Peter. He's driving somewhere in Connecticut. We're talking about Shake Shack and the best burger in town. Morning or good afternoon, Peter. I'm sorry.
Good morning. Yeah, I'm a Bostonian living in New York City, and I can tell you that I think Shake Shack does have staying power. However, everybody standing in line in Times Square and Madison Square Park are really tourists. And now, if you're ever in Madison Square Park, 23rd Street in New York City, just go across Madison Avenue to Schnippers, where the burgers are frankly better.
Schnippers.
Or go over to Brooklyn and go to Peter Luger's Steakhouse for a higher-end burger.
I've had it at Peter Luger's. It's pretty incredible. I agree. It's a long time ago, but really good.
And then lastly, in Boston, I don't think you can beat, for the lower-end price point, R.F. O'Sullivan's
in Somerville. Great burger.
How about that? That's on Beacon Street, right? Richard. Is that where it is?
That's right.
That's right.
And you know what they do there? They don't push the meat down, and it stays nice and juicy.
That's a big deal.
And it's a great burger.
Hey, Peter, beautifully said. What do you
think
about that?
What do you think?
I'm not a fan. I've never been a fan of O'Sullivan's.
Really?
I've tried it a few times. To me, it's like this giant, like, softball of a burger that they cook it fairly well, but they don't season it at all, so it just has not a lot of flavor to
me. What do you mean push it down? Why would you push it down?
People push it down to get it flattened,
yeah.
But, like, so they don't. So you end up with, like, it really looks like a softball in a bun.
But the juice comes out also. It destroys all the...
Exactly.
What was the name of the spectacular, I'm just drawing a blank, who used to be called the Butcher of Broadway before he became a political...
Frank Rich.
I mean, his reputation when he was a Broadway critic before he became a political writer for the Times, and now he's no longer there, was a bad review from him could shut down a Broadway play overnight. If you trash a burger on your blog... What's the impact of that? And do the restaurants complain to you or no?
I've had a few complaints, but I don't know. I feel like if I like it, it'll get people to go. If I don't like it, people are still going to go because I want to know, wow, he didn't like it. I got to see how bad it is kind of a thing. But it's I've found that in these last 4 or 5 years of writing this blog, people are so passionate about the burgers they like, specific places they like. So it started a lot of conversations and a lot of back and forth. So
Richard, the bottom line is we can go to the Shake Shack and have a good burger, not a great burger. It'll be sort of fun. The milkshakes go along with it.
Exactly.
Maybe the custard for dessert kind of thing. A nice low-fat. Nice low-fat kind of meal.
Yeah, nice healthy meal. It's a very good burger. You'll enjoy it, but set your expectations a little lower than I think people have been hyping it up.
Let's get your review of two more things. We don't have time for the calls. Mark is calling, and he is asking about the five napkin burger at the Prue, and Brendan is calling and saying, what do you think of the Neptune oyster burger? How about either of them? You familiar with
it? Yeah, five napkin, you know, a couple years ago received a lot of hype, almost what Shake Shack is receiving now. It's a very good burger, too. I think the hype, for me, sort of killed that. It's a good burger, but didn't deliver quite what I thought it would.
How about Neptune Oyster?
Neptune's
familiar with that?
Pretty good. It's, you know, obviously a seafood place in the North End. So it's a burger. They have fried oysters on it. So it works. It works pretty well.
How many do you eat a week on an average week? I want to see if you're the real deal.
Really only about 1 to 2 a week.
1 to 2 a
week?
You know, you should weigh,
I should be
like...
doing the burger blog, not you, Richard.
And you're pretty fit over there, Richard. You're not
Thank you.
5,000 pounds or anything. I mean, I am starving. Aren't you?
I just have one last question for him. I'm a little hungry, but I'm always a little hungry. Do you always wear burger socks, or do you just wear them for this particular occasion?
It was a special occasion. You guys got it, yeah.
Richard Shaw, you're great. You should check him out at bostonburgerblog.com, and he and his fiancée are the people behind the catering service called The Skinny Beat. Great to see you, Richard.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Richard, for being here. Up next, it's Open Mic with Christopher Lydon, a fascinating analysis of Mayor Tom Menino's turn and term. Stay tuned to that conversation on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This hour of Boston Public Radio is coming to you fundraiser-free, thanks to Bernadette in Littleton.
And Susan in Newton.
And Thomas in West Roxbury.
And the thousands of other WGBH sustainers who keep this station going with small monthly contributions that automatically renew.
When Boston Public Radio can count on your support, you can count on less time fundraising and more Boston Public Radio.
It's easy to sign on as a sustainer. Just call 888-897-9424.
And thanks.
We love our contributors. That means you. And Miller Systems, designing and delivering websites, intranets, and portals on Microsoft SharePoint. Miller Systems, since 1995. Quality user experiences. Technology that's right for the job. MillerSystems.com/SharePoint. And High School Quiz Show. See young Massachusetts scholars compete in a fierce head-to-head battle of the brains. Who will claim victory this week? Don't miss High School Quiz Show, Sunday at 6:30 on WGBH2.
You listen to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. If our next guest had been successful in 1993, there'd be no speculation about whether Tom Menino was running for a sixth term this fall. We're joined on Open Mic by 1993 mayoral candidate Chris Lydon, today of Radio Open Source. Remember that campaign, Chris?
3.5% of the people can't be wrong, Jim. Don't forget that. Ask me sometime why I call it the, you know, I was the winner among the non-hacks.
How many
there
candidates were there? Nine? Was it nine?
And it was fun. Tom Menino and I sat next to each other. Lydon Menino had to be
right
together. And he would say, to anybody, I'm not a fancy talker. Meaning, I am not Chris Lydon.
And brother, and it, in 1993, again, there were nine candidates. Menino, I believe, because Flynn had left, obviously, for the Vatican job. He had served, what, 2 months, 3 months? He'd been interim mayor for a very short period of time, right? Am I right about that?
Yeah, yeah. And he had, shall we say, the city hacks. He had the machine. And he was an interesting candidate. And I think deep down, we kind of liked each other. But, you know, I asked him during that race, I would say to people, I want to know the question to which the answer is Tom Menino. And I never really got it. And I mean, today, 20 years later, sadly, that Filene's Hall in the center of downtown is the kind of icon of where we're at. But I still think the important thing is, what is the question? And to me, it's, what are we going to do about this eclipse of Boston politics? Why no competition for so many years? Why do the city numbers sound so good and the public spirit not so good? And why does the very solid infrastructure that he's built, those new curbs, the luxury housing, the public tennis courts, the pocket parks, I'm thinking of South Street and Jamaica Plain, for example, why do they look so spiffy when the public conversation around this job, it's an important one, is so nothing? And what is the real Menino effect? I mean, the answer to the question, you know, why Tom Menino, we know it now. The answer turns out to be, do you want a man who will fall in love with the job, work it night and day, an urban mechanic, he calls himself, and he is. He's a micromanager, and I think you could say in a good way. He meets everybody, says almost nothing. But at the same time, he's enforcing, I think, a kind of eclipse on public argument, dissent, criticism, experimental thinking. He's also a guy who can, you know, effectively sweep the power and the money decisions of this city under an absolutely impenetrable rug at the Boston Redevelopment Authority. We don't know what's going on there. They're not subject to city council's review. They make up their own laws as they go. I worry, and a lot of other people do, that he's giving away the city tax base in a lot of this new construction. I mean, $25 million in help for the Liberty Mutual extension there on Columbus Avenue at Berkeley Street. This is a gigantic, hugely rich company that pays its CEO $50 million a year.
Ted Kelly.
Yeah, and they're getting these huge breaks from the city of Boston. At the same time, and we'll come to the key issue, I think, the schools, both as actual management of 125 city schools, and as a metaphor of growth, the next generation, the young people in this city is unanswered.
Well, you were John Connolly's kickoff yesterday, were you not?
I was.
And that's the centerpiece, if not his whole campaign, is about the quality of the schools in 2013, is it not?
Well, yeah, he's hugely invested in it, I think, as a father, as a candidate, as a person, and he's had experience teaching. I mean, in so many ways, he says things that I tried less effectively to say 20 years ago. But I think also the times have changed. People are ready to hear. We know now in a competitive world economy that education is everything. And we're ready to deal with it.
Let me answer. Before you continue, I just want to say one. You said, 20 years later, what is the question to which the answer is Tom Menino? I think I know the answer. It's the same question that many people think was the divide between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama. Who cares more about us? And if the question is, who cares about us? I think the answer in the minds of an overwhelming number of people in Boston is Tom Menino. The number I've cited a million times, I think even actually in the 4 weeks we've been here, in a Boston Globe poll when he ran 4 years ago, 57% of the people who live in Boston said they had met him personally. Not seen him in an event, not seen him at their kid's school, but had personally met Tom Menino. That's a staggering number. And I think what that translates into in the minds of most people, Chris Lydon, is this guy cares enough about me to come talk to me, to not be in his castle atop that horrible structure at City Hall Plaza, but he comes out and meets the people. That counts for a lot, no?
Sure it does, Jim, but it doesn't really answer the question. I mean, what is the effect after all these years? Of course he knows people, but Michael Bloomberg has given New York City many different things, including that wonderful Highline Park, a war on supersized drinks, not to mention for example, recently this wonderful micro modular housing experiment. Where is that in our city? I mean, Rahm Emanuel in Chicago at least confronted the teachers' union and had a good fight about longer days. And
he's presiding kind of over the murder capital of the world.
No, nothing's perfect. But the question is, what is the mark of the Menino years? To my mind, he wasted a huge opportunity to rebuild that South Boston waterfront. It could have been the Back Bay or better. It looks like sort of the bad end of Houston. There are lots of other things, but I mean, where's the monument? Some of these things aren't clear till a long time after it. I didn't really realize until after Kevin White died that his decision, and there were others in on it, Frank Sargent, Mike Dukakis, but to stop I-95 coming through Jamaica Plain and Boston was a historic.
Brilliant.
It remade
Changed
the city.
Changed everything.
Changed it. It got us back from the brink. It is now, but it took 40 years. It's been painted, spiffed, remiddle classified. Is Tom Menino even approaching that? I mean, to me, what's the question?
No, he's got. To me, it's much more simple. It's he has done a lot with parks. When he was elected mayor, the only parks in the city of Boston which were any good were in South Boston. Now the parks in Jamaica Plain and Roslindale and Dorchester and Roxbury have improved. The city, the parks are better. He's had no great competition. I don't think Peggy Davis Mullen or Michael Flaherty or Maura Hannigan, the people that ran against him, have been very.
What do you hold that against him?
Because no, but I think that's been very significant, and he's got. A whole machine that is afraid to make a move to get him upset. He's got a temper. He's very short. You make a bad move in the city of Boston, Tom Menino has some power over you, you're in big, serious trouble. And
before we continue, I should
hope,
do this. Before
I hope
Chris,
he's listening. Okay.
Emily Rooney this morning did an interview that's going to be on Greater Boston tonight with Tom Menino. And one of the questions she asked him was about his track record on schools. Listen to this part of the conversation.
Yes, you judge me any way you want to judge me. I tell you, when you think about the dropout rate in the schools down to 5% or 6%, you think about more kids going on to college than ever before, you know, more graduate, 68% of our kids graduate from high school. I mean, what else? I mean, yeah, we're not perfect. I'll never say the Boston Public Schools are perfect, but we accept every child. We don't discriminate against a kid because of English is language problems or he has a disability. We take every kid who walks in that door, we educate him.
20 years ago, a candidate for mayor said that he would visit a public school every day. Quote, you can mark me absent if I'm not there. That was you, Christopher Lydon.
That was me.
Chris Lydon said he would go up against the teachers' union. And the fact that Tom Menino, with all the power he's amassed in all these years, has not done that significantly. John Conley would tell you this last contract was like a given to the teachers' union. You talked about this when you ran for mayor, and you're right.
What was the first thing, you know, Rudy Giuliani did in New York was to confront the teachers' union. You hate to do it because we love teachers. We want them to be better paid, but we want them, you know, we have an incredibly short school day for teachers, 6 hours in Boston, Jim, compared to seven and a half as a routine around the country. But, I mean, some of this gets very personal. I have three kids who went to Boston Public Schools, have marvelous lives and wonderful people. Why are my kids in Jamaica Plain moving to the burbs into private schools that they cannot afford to escape this absurd lottery of a few good schools for seats in a few good schools?
Well, you know, there is there's a brand new school assignment plan, which even John Connolly, when he was in the studio with us a couple of weeks ago, said is a step in the right direction.
Well,
it's
many
not the
steps,
whole
small step.
Look, families are still, including my own, with great regret, leaving the city because they feel bound to give their kids a first-class school opportunity. And they pay $30,000 for, you know, that's after-tax, hard-working income to do it. And they leave the city. That's fundamentally wrong. I was just thinking, and John Conley, this is a lift from John Conley, but I think there's real wisdom in it. City politics in Boston should be centering on 40-year-olds with kids. We know that's the future. We know these are families that give every kind of vitality to the famous neighborhoods. Tom Menino has not centered his life on that. I think he's paid very little attention to that as a fundamental riddle. I mean, here we are in the teaching, learning capital of the world, and we know that it is the core of the vitality of Massachusetts and New England's future. In a certain sense, always has been, but here we are 40-plus, whatever, 60 maybe, institutions of higher learning clustered around the Twin Towers of Harvard and MIT. That's why we're here. That's why we're all here personally. That's why GBH is here. Boston has never picked up that clue phone. I think that's where John Conley has a step this time, in that I think the conversation around the world, around the country, we don't do it perfectly well yet, but we know that education in a new technology, in a new economy, is absolutely critical.
Our number is 877-301-8970. You're listening to the voice of Chris Lawton. He's with us every Thursday at 1 o'clock. Chris posed the question, what is the question to which Tom Menino is the answer? When you listen to Emily Rooney's interview with Menino tonight at 7 o'clock, the full interview, well, he never says in so many words, I'm running for a sixth term. The sense one gets pretty strongly is that he is. So the corollary question is, how do you rate the first 20? And does the first 20 merit at least another four? 877-301-8970. A recent statistic, you've read this, Chris Lawton, is that the percentage of high school kids in Boston who go to college who graduate within 6 years is significantly higher in Boston than the state average. That's pretty rare for an urban center to exceed a state average in a fairly wealthy state like that. Does that not show progress?
Jim, I can't argue all those detailed numbers. I wish I could. Next time.
Well, it's true.
It is, well, I would argue it's because in Boston you have places like the exam schools, which make a big difference. And there's no exam schools in Lawrence. There's no exam schools in Fall River or Brockton.
But every major urban area in the United States of America, Marjorie, that's in the same size and breadth of Boston has the same sorts of issues, has to let everybody in. They have an exam school. I grew up in Philadelphia. I went to the exam school. It raised the standards for virtually everybody else.
Right.
But the quality of schools in Philadelphia is not something that I think you're going to write home about either.
No. I'm saying that I'm not surprised that Boston has a better average than schools like the Brocktons and the Fall Rivers. Jim, you have to understand Christopher Lydon is totally in the tank with the Teachers Unions of America because they gave him a big award. The Massachusetts Teachers Association gave him a big award a while ago.
They did get the spirit of full disclosure. I did get the president's award.
Except for those
true.
Who are totally in the tank, like Jim, I don't think there's any question that rules about merit pay and rules about longer school day and rules about paying phenomenal amounts of money to great teachers would totally alter the school systems in the public cities of America.
Let me pick up one thread there. Jim, I am a social democrat. I believe in an activist government. I love taxes almost as much as you.
I would say that's unlikely. Because...
And you never met one you didn't like. But Boston is overtaxed. I think it's badly run, but the costs of what we pay for what we get are way out of line with cities in the rest of the country.
So, Chris Lyon, before we get to the calls, what are the people of Boston not getting since they reelect him by massive numbers that you get? How are they missing what you consider to be and what John Connolly considers to be the obvious?
Well, because he does it, he works the job, Jim, lovingly, and he's there. I think a lot of people are aware that's not enough. There is another intimidation factor. I don't want to overdo it, but he is known as a nasty infighter and a vindictive guy who remembers every slight, and you don't want to get out of line, and neither do contributors or even commentators or architects. I've been through a lot of this. People don't want to talk about Tom Menino. They don't want to make an issue of it.
Chris, you've been around a while. You worked for the New York Times. What major urban mayor who's been successful or at least had a long shelf life in the last 40 years in America wouldn't fit that same description? They're tough. They're vindictive.
Ray
you
Flynn.
Cross them.
Ray Flynn.
Kevin White loved an argument about everything. Mm-hmm. And he was wide open to a million ideas. He was very well aware of what other things were being done in other cities in the country. And he wanted to be known as experimental, as talkative, as engaged. Tom Menino is the most inarticulate mayor in the nation. And it hurts.
And
I'm sure it hurts him. And I don't mean to be nasty about it. But we don't have a conversation about city issues. Which reminds me, I just want to throw out a line for this mayor's race in general. I think this could be the moment for at least a discussion of charter reform. Nobody
Absolutely.
Really knows how this city works. Nobody really
The charter is the constitution, essentially, for the city, for lack of a better expression, for those that don't know. These
right.
charters. Yeah, go ahead.
Right. And the basic rules of a separation of powers between legislative, executive, and judicial
What
authority.
Change would you make?
I might just dissolve the Boston Redevelopment Authority. I would separate the planning and the development functions. I would put it under the review of the Boston City Council. I would make a court order that the papers had to cover it, and programs like this had to discuss it, had to get into the details. I mean, I remember the early days of Ed Logue and screaming contests.
BRA guy, right?
The original head of the BRA, and or the effectively speaking under John Collins. But screaming contests with Kitty Craven and Bill Foley on the floor of the Boston City Council, all that has been abolished now because the City Council has no review of anything that the BRA does. When you're a developer and you go, you have a project, the BRA process is essentially one, Jim, of telling you, okay, these are the corners we have to cut. These are the laws that we have to override, height, sidewalk, mm-hmm. Whatever. And it's a secret process. It's virtually impenetrable. It's got to be opened up.
Let's go to the calls. We have lines that are full to talk to Christopher Lydon about Tom Menino, and he posed it beautifully. What's the question to which Tom Menino is the answer? Let's go to Josh in Worcester, which I don't believe is in Menino's district, but nevertheless, Josh, welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Help us out, Josh.
Hi.
Well, I'm actually a resident of Boston, but I happen to be out of
Worcester. Okay, I was kidding. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say it's incredibly refreshing to hear some of these sort of critical questions finally being raised. I don't hear it raised hardly at all. And I really agree. I wonder what Menino's actual vision is. I think it's great that we have pocket parks. I think it's great that he's redeveloping the waterfront, but I think really what we're getting is sort of a, not a visionary. We're just getting a sort of well-oiled status quo, and it looks nice, sort of. But, where's the High Line Park? Where's the skyscraper? Where's something? A monument to what he's done and what our city stands
That's
for.
My question, Josh. I asked about the South Boston waterfront and what an opportunity that represented to build something beautiful. I always compare it to the Back Bay. It's about the same size. I mean, the Back Bay will live forever as a kind of model of city living. And he said, I don't want to be remembered by no buildings.
He's a guy
who thinks service, who thinks accessibility. I don't think he lets you in on the big decisions, though, on the big conversations. When people meet him and they remember him, he's a hardworking guy on the job. But really, Jim, what does that tell you? I mean, what does that give you in the end?
Well, you meet people. I mean, I think that's one of the things. Everybody in Boston says they've met Tom Menino and they continue to vote
Marjorie,
for him.
You and I have co-emceed the Mother's Day March for Peace,
yep,
which is a thing in May.
He's there every year.
Well, not just there, which are the families of people whose sons, daughters, husbands, wives have been murdered in Boston. What do they all say about Tom Menino?
That they've met Tom
not
Menino.
Not just met him, but that he's somebody who they think, I mean, I don't mean to...
Cares about the city of Boston. And there's not any big corruption that I think people see in front of them as there typically is this far into a multi-term mayor kind of deal.
Before you continue, Josh asked the question, what's the vision? One of the questions, Emily Rooney, again, you can hear the whole interview tonight on Greater Boston with Emily. She interviewed Tom Menino this morning. Here's Tom Menino's answer to a question very similar to that.
I don't mind a debate at all on the issues. Let's not get into throwing mud at each other. I'm not into that. I've never done that in my whole career, and I will not do it in these years either. It's important that we talk about what is your vision for the future? What are you going to do with the waterfront? What are you going to do with schools, with downtown Crossing? What about the neighborhoods of our city?
You know, I have to say, Chris, I've lived in Philadelphia, I've lived in New York City, I've lived here. I think the problem is not at all Tom Menino. I think the problem is the opposition. And I say that, I don't mean John Connolly, I have no idea what kind of candidate he's going to be. I've never lived in a major city where there is less opposition, even constructive opposition, on virtually anything. Now, one might say, well, that's because he's so tough and so vindictive. I don't buy that at all. Really? I lived in New York City with Ed Koch. Doesn't get much more vindictive than Ed Koch. There were pockets, serious pockets of opposition. Anything he said, they popped up. There were serious public debates. Why is there virtually no public debate in Boston?
That's a tremendously important question, Jim. It's a little bit like the Filene's hole. There is a hole in the soul of this conversation. We think of Boston as a very, very political place. I discovered in the radio, people are not into politics in any inordinate way. And in the city of Boston, I mean, half of the eligible voters in the city of Boston have never voted for mayor. This very limp, meaningless editorial stirring of the pot around here. There's no kind of credible watchdog group anymore. I mean, we had so many historic, some of them meaningless rivalries, but it used to be, you know, the Yanks looking over the those thieving Irishmen like James Michael Curley, the last hurrah and all that. We had a certain amount of, you know, the West Roxbury Irish against the South Boston Irish in the Collins and Powers days. We had sort of racially tinged races through the White Flynn era. I don't know where the, I mean, and I always thought the racial divide was way, way exaggerated, but I and then a little bit of a sort of, can an Italian win in a mayor's fight in Boston, but that's meaningless too. You're right. There is not a sort of generative spark.
Sort of a pogo-esque problem.
Let's go
squeeze
to Charlene
one more
from South Boston. Go ahead, Charlene. You're on with Christopher Lydon.
Hi, yeah. I listened to NPR quite a bit and just was so happy to hear this conversation. I've missed quite a bit of it, so maybe the answer's already been discussed.
No, it hasn't. We have no answers.
Go ahead, Charlene.
Yeah, I'm just calling to see if there's absolutely any hope in the near 2 years for any kind of quality public schools in South Boston. My husband and I just moved here two years ago. We have a 2.5-year-old and a 6-month-old. Mm. We're currently paying nearly $40,000 a year in daycare. And she felt lucky to get into the daycare. We're both PhDs. We have decent incomes, but if we have any hope of growing our savings, it's just not financially feasible to stay in the South Boston area, which we love.
Charlene, you are the voice of the people. You're a 30s, 40s mother of children, and you're critical to the future. Who knows who's going to satisfy Charlene's vital need? But let me just say another angle that we don't hear enough. This is a wonderful time to be a city. It's a wonderful, wonderful time to be Boston. A huge, not huge, but a very solid old infrastructure of interesting, good housing in a variety of neighborhoods. We're surrounded by growth industries in technology, genomic medicine, education. These are here to stay. And what a wonderful time to sort of rethink the city as an innovative, experimental place in government. For example, we have 50,000+ school kids in the city of Boston, a perfect laboratory for something that the whole world wants to know is how do you educate for a modern world across lines of class and gender and national origin. This has traditionally been an immigrant city, but that's a solvable problem for a mayor that wants to make that the almost exclusive priority.
Last question. We're out of time, Chris Lydon. Had you won in 1993, would you be seeking your sixth term now in 2013?
As president or what?
Christopher Lydon with us every Thursday at 1 o'clock. Chris, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Christopher Lydon.
Draft me.
He's with us every Thursday at 1 o'clock for Open Mic. Tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with Emily Rooney. Okay, we're going to be continuing Jim has done a series on obesity. We're going to continue that conversation with a look on whether advertising has a role in tipping the scales. That's next on Boston Public Radio.
The NRA, the National Rifle Association, wants a good guy with a gun in every school. Easier than it sounds.
Being in charge of 7 different schools, the chances of me being in that school when something happens are pretty slim.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The return on investment of armed guards on campus next time on Marketplace. It's from 8 p.m.
Tonight at 6 here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and A24, presenting the film Ginger and Rosa, directed by Sally Potter, starring Elle Fanning, Christina Hendricks, Annette Bening, and Alessandro Nivola, opens at Kendall Square Cinema on March 22nd. And New England Subaru, offering the Subaru Outback with symmetrical all-wheel drive. More information available online at SubaruofNewEngland.com. That's SubaruofNewEngland.com.
This is Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. It is day 3, even though we didn't intend this, of our discussion of causes and cures of obesity. 2 days ago, Marjorie was away. We discussed what government's role was in protecting us from ourselves with things like soda-sized bans a la Bloomberg. Then yesterday, Marjorie, you missed this too. This is great. Rather than calorie counts, there's this new move to list how many miles you need to walk to work off that soda. And today, a whole different theme. We're joined in Studio 3 by Chris Chabris. He's the co-author of The Invisible Gorilla. I love that. How Our Institutions Deceive Us. He also co-authored a recent piece, which is why he's here, for the New York Times, entitled Does This Ad Make Me Fat? Chris Chabris, welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being with us, Chris. So what is the answer? Do these ads make us fat? If our little kids weren't after Cocoa Krispies after they saw them on TV, would they be craving them and stuffing their little mouths with them?
Well, it sounds like an easy question to answer.
Yes.
So, and what my article was about and what I think we need to think about before we try to start regulating ads, taxing them, do all that kind of stuff is do we really know whether they make us fat? It seems like it's a logical thing that could happen, right? If kids see ads and they like to have the stuff there, well, that seems like they must make us fat. But if people buy the stuff they see advertised, maybe they're not buying something else. So it might be that ads are causing people to substitute different foods for one another instead of actually increase their total amount of calories.
Well, this, the thing about the billboards, too, I mean, you made the argument in your piece that the question is whether the people in the neighborhood seeing the billboards are then going out and buying the fattening food and getting fat, or whether advertisers advertise in particular neighborhoods. And there's a lot of correlation between poverty and obesity, advertising in certain neighborhoods because they know that's where the people are going to be buying the fattening foods they're pushing.
Right. So there, what we wrote about was a study that found that people who live in neighborhoods with a higher percentage of ads for food are in fact more likely to be obese. So they're, the ads for food correlate with the amount of obesity in neighborhoods. But what the article sort of that we were critiquing didn't really talk much about was that this could be because the food advertisers put their ads where their likely customers are going to be. If someone is already obese, it seems like they're a good customer for food. If somebody is not obese, it seems like they're a good customer for fitness products or something like that instead.
Who's the guy who said rob banks because that's where the money is? I mean, it wasn't Capone, was it?
No,
but it's a variation of that theme. You're suggesting it may be that they put the ads where they know people are going to eat this sort of stuff. Now, Chris Chabris, yeah. I am as unscientific a sample as possible, but I'm going to pick myself. When I was a kid, raised by a single mother, I was an only child, I know for a fact, and I mean this sincerely, every horrible food that I saw on television, as soon as my mother got home from work, I said, I want that. And the next day, I had that. So that other than the replacement effect, and I know that's not your scientific term, but what you just described, maybe you're just substituting one bad food for another. My anecdotal random example is I ate everything that I saw on television. That's pretty compelling evidence, isn't
everything,
it?
Everything.
No, I'm serious. I really did.
You don't look that big, but
I was that big. Believe me, I was.
I think that's why the study that was done was a good one, because we all have our own experiences. You may have thought that you were bugging your mom to get every horrible food that you saw, and you were eating them all and getting
the worse the better.
Exactly. So that's why we do these large scale studies, and we survey lots of people, and we see whether that anecdotal experience really generalizes to the whole population. So I don't really have a problem with the fact that there's a correlation between ads and obesity. That seems pretty borne out and pretty logical. The question is what's causing that, and if it really is advertisers just putting their ads where obese people already live, then taxing the ads might not actually solve the problem, or restricting the ads might not reduce obesity. Mm-hmm.
But also the problem with your theory, Jim, is that when you were a little boy, in the 70s or 60s, eating every food that your mother asked you for, the whole country wasn't rolling to school because we were so big. I mean, this is a fairly...
I was rolling to school.
Well, you may have been rolling to school, but this is a fairly recent phenomenon, which seems to me as more...
You mean the explosion of the obesity crisis
explosion
in this country.
And part of it to me is also, fewer mothers have time to cook, and fewer kids go out after school because everybody's afraid that their children are going to be abducted. So they stay inside the house, getting heavier and heavier and heavier.
Yeah, my research specialty is not obesity, by the way. My research specialty is how people think. But I think that there are lots of probable explanations for obesity, because it's whenever you have something that's changing over time like that so dramatically, it's probably a lot of things that change with the times that have to do with it. Less running around outside.
Right.
Calories are cheaper than they ever were. You know, for a dollar, you can buy a Snickers bar. It's like 540 calories or something like that. I mean, that's cheap calories. That's not the way things were when our ancestors were around and so on. There are lots of differences between now and in the past.
Well, can you weigh in? And I don't mean that as – well, I do mean it as a pun, actually, on something we were discussing the last couple of days. Whether – they don't do it on billboards. I think they should. This move afoot in chains. One, to put calorie counts. Two, the thing we discussed yesterday out of the University of North Carolina, that the impact might be greater if I knew not that a supersized soda was 500 calories, I'm not sure what it is, but that to drink a supersized soda, I'd have to walk from here to Cleveland to work the soda off. Does any of that stuff have an impact on decision-making in terms of food purchases?
I think it can have an impact, and the evidence that I heard of suggests that just putting the calories in the menu doesn't really change that much. People's consumption at Burger King, you know, didn't change much when they found out how many calories were in the burger. The reason I like the idea of putting the amount of miles you have to work or the amount of, you know, push-ups you have to do or whatever is that it's much more concrete to think walking a long distance than it is to think of a calorie. Nobody really knows what a calorie is.
Nor do you know how many calories you're supposed to have.
Yeah. I mean, well, everybody knows like 2,000 or something. What's 2,000 calories? Nobody, you know, that's very abstract. And even if you said I'm supposed to have 2,000 calories, it doesn't appear to you as something that's costly to you, like walking another mile or walking to Cleveland or whatever. So in general, the mind is better at handling concrete information and thinking about things that we can easily visualize, and visualizing all the exercise we have to do is a lot more concrete than visualizing abstract numbers of calories. So I like the idea, but it still has to be tested. I think it seems logical, right? Okay, we're gonna put it down in miles walked.
Big billboard with Doritos, and say you must walk 4 miles at a 5 minute per mile pace or something, and that might dissuade me from down in the Doritos.
But are you not serious? No, I think it might.
I think, Chris, you have a great point, because I think that although I was kind of shocked when I found out there were like 9 million calories in like a cafe latte macchiato or whatever it was when Starbucks started doing it, I was stunned how many calories there were in that.
You have to walk cross country after that one,
Marjorie. Yeah, but that's a good one, though, if you think about it that way. That's right, because who wants to do 75 push-ups?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds good, right? It might work. It sounds better than just putting the calories on. But I think one of the points we were trying to make in our article is you need to test these things with experiments. You can't just assume that because they make sense or because they reflect some kind of correlation that they're going to actually work. So if you're going to do that, what I would do is instead of making it the law of the land tomorrow, I would make it the law of the land in a few selected randomly chosen locations, mm-hmm. see what happens to obesity or at least consumption or something that might have to do with obesity in those areas, not just whether it deters people from going to those restaurants that have the jogging symbol on them and go to the other restaurants or something, really an experiment, a scientific experiment, randomized like you're testing a new drug, and see whether this new regulation really does reduce obesity. That's what we have to do.
Chris Chabris, a last question from me. Has the reverse, and I don't know if I'm enunciating this properly, but I'll try my best. The absence of ads, for example, cigarette ads. I don't remember what year it was under C. Edward Koop or whomever. Cigarette ads came off TV or wherever they came off. Cigarette consumption started to drop. Now, admittedly, that's in conjunction with other public education campaigns. So even if you can't prove conclusively that affirmative ads, for lack of a better expression, cause a certain behavior, like to eat more or worse things than you should, haven't we seen evidence that the absence of ads have caused the change in behavior, which gets us somewhere? You understand my question?
Yes. Okay. The question is, hasn't smoking gone down because ads
in
for,
part
for
because
cigarettes?
In part because there are no ads,
So I think that's a great hypothesis. There's a lot of logic behind that. But of course, other things have changed. Just that, you know, smoking has been taken, you know, off of TV shows as well. Smoking has just become, less, it's more morally frowned upon. I mean, people who smoke are looked at differently now than they were 30 or 40 mm-hmm. years ago, right? It just seems like a disgusting behavior to more people. My mother smoked for 50 years and you know, people just, you know, view that differently now. What we really, you know, need to do to figure that out is see whether there was some place where they changed the smoking laws, you know, earlier or later, or not the smoking laws, but the ads earlier or later and so on, and see if that had an effect on changes in smoking. And none of this has to do, by the way, with whether it's morally right or wrong. I mean, if we make a moral judgment that smoking is sort of a wrong thing to do or that tempting, you know, people who are already obese with food ads is somehow morally wrong, well, we can enact our moral preferences. We don't always have to just enact what social science requires. But if we're going to claim that social science is supporting all these regulations, we ought to get the social science right and really make sure that it shows what we say it does.
Chris Chabris is the co-author of The Invisible Gorilla, How Our Institutions Deceive Us. He also co-authored a recent piece in The Times. You should Google this. It's a great piece. It's entitled, did you write the headline or the paper wrote the headline?
No, I don't write the headline.
Does this ad make me fat is what it was called.
Absolutely.
Chris, it was great
just
to see you.
Just looking at it.
Thanks so much for coming in. We appreciate it. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Okay. Coming up, it's the real life three-dimensional woman behind Lisa Simpson. What brings her to Boston? That conversation is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
The new film Olympus Has Fallen has a terrifying premise, a terrorist attack on the White House, a captured president. What could be more fun than that, says director Antoine Fuqua.
Take the audience on a roller coaster ride. You know, why not? It has everything in it that a filmmaker would want.
We speak with him and one of the film's many stars, Angela Bassett, next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs exist because of you and the Harvard Innovation Lab, where entrepreneurs from across Harvard, the Alston community, Boston, and beyond engage in teaching and learning in pursuit of taking their innovative ideas to the world. ilab.harvard.edu. And the Lincoln Motor Company, introducing the 2013 MKZ Hybrid, a luxury car with an EPA-estimated 45 city miles per gallon. More information at lincoln.com. Actual mileage will vary.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. For more than a quarter of a century, our next guest has probably spent more time in your home than you have, in the person of Lisa Simpson. Now, she doesn't just want to make you laugh, but have you feel and look good in Marche Vu shoes. Joining us in the studio is, I guess, the founder of Lisa Simpson and Marche Vu. She's unveiling her Spring 2013 footwear collection at 6:30 tonight at Sol Amor in Andover. Welcome, Yardley Smith.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, this is like, if the choice today was to have Barack Obama or you, I have to say the excitement in this building about you.
It's not true, Jim.
No, it is totally true, Yardley. I'm telling you.
Well, it's two things. It is, of course, Lisa Simpson. And, you know, many of us have spent untold hours. And it is so funny because, of course, you don't have this big...
You don't have the starfish head.
You don't have the saxophone with you. And you don't sound like this, you have a regular voice.
I do. I mean, this is me and this is Lisa Simpson. It's not that far.
It's not that far to go. It's not that far.
You know, if you heard Dan, who does Homer, Dan Castellaneta, mm-hmm. you would never in a million years know that he does Homer Simpson.
Well, I didn't know until today that people do multiple voices
I'm the only one who does one.
Are you guys all in the room? Do you do this like
we do
all
it like
together?
Like an old radio show?
And yeah. So when someone does multiple voices, which you say everybody does other than you,
yes.
Do they break and talk to each other? If they're talking to each other, they just change persona?
Yeah, it's brilliant. It never gets old. I could watch that all day long. They just go from voice to voice to voice. Like Dan does Homer and Grandpa.
Right.
So, and he has a conversation between Homer and Grandpa, and he just goes from one to the other seamlessly. It is beautiful.
And I read that more than a quarter of a century ago on the great Tracy Ullman show, your dream or desire was to be Bart, not Lisa. Is that correct?
No.
Am I wrong?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's okay.
It's okay. Once in a while.
No, it's a funny thing. I actually read for Bart.
Oh.
But I had no preconceived notion. I hadn't had a character picked out. I hadn't even been told about Lisa when I showed up for my audition. So I read for Bart. I sound too much like a girl. There was no getting around it. So they handed me a picture of Lisa and said, she's the sister and she's the middle child and she's 8. And I thought, well, I think I sound like I'm roughly 10 years old in real life. So she's 8, so I'm going to go a little bit higher. So I went up like that. And they were like, that's great. And then like a day later, I had the job. And I said, awesome. And the job is what? We're doing what?
Well, so you just answered a call for an audition. This is how
yes.
you became Lisa Simpson?
Yes.
You just showed up. How many other would-be Lisas were there? Do you have any idea?
No idea, actually. It was a very, first of all, the woman who cast The Simpsons had actually seen me in a play in Hollywood in this ratty little theater that I think 17 people saw that play, and she was one of them. And it was a year prior to that, right, to my audition. And so she said, I know exactly who should play Lisa Simpson. So regardless of her commentary, they brought me in to read for Bart. And then it was so long ago, my audition was on a tape recorder. We had to push play and record. Remember that, children?
We're talking to Yardley Smith. If you want to talk to her, the number is 877-301-8970. Now, Yardley, Marjorie said she was really excited to talk to you because of the Lisa Simpson thing. To be candid, I don't give a damn about Lisa Simpson. I'm into the shoes. I mean, who cares about the Simpsons? Now, what is with this shoe deal with you? I mean, you have no, from what I read, you had no background other than liking comfortable, beautiful shoes. Then all of a sudden, what, 3-4 years ago, you decided to do this thing? Where'd that come from?
Yeah, well, you know, I've already sort of lived my life by screw it, let's do it. So I realized I didn't have any beautiful, comfortable shoes in my closet. And I thought, I can do that.
Nobody has beautiful, comfortable shoes in their closet. You don't get
Marjorie's
this.
Marjorie's so
you
excited.
You don't get this because you are a man.
I am a man.
This is any woman over 35, when the wear and tear of wearing those spike heels, those ridiculous shoes, begins to take its toll on your feet, you spend the rest of your life from 35 on trying to find a sexy pair of shoes to wear to a wedding that is not going to cause you, before the wedding ceremony is even over, to take them off and massage your
feet. And blood coming out of your eyes.
Exactly.
I totally get it.
Exactly. It's horrible. So tell us about these marchez-vous. Now, what does that mean in French?
It means you walk.
You walk. Okay. I mean, a can you walk could be put in before that, because most of us can't walk. So tell us about we have to get back to The Simpsons in a minute.
We will. Fine.
But tell me about the shoes and why I'm going to be able to walk in your shoes.
Well, part of it is the Poron. Poron is a dual density foam that was invented by NASA. And they said NASA, and I'm like, I'm in. It's all good. So it's like having a little Tempur-Pedic mattress under the ball of your foot.
Oh.
A lot of them have a hidden platform, so that mitigates the slope, you know, if we're talking about a high heel. My design directive is, I have no formal design training, but I take classic shapes and apply exquisite details. At the end of the day, I just want to make a beautiful shoe. And I say, people say, what's your demographic? I say, I make shoes for women who know what they want. We want the right equipment for the right job, whether that is a husband, a car, a nanny, or a pair of shoes. Right? So and at
are you wearing a pair right now, or you not? Can you put your foot up so we can see? I'll try to describe it. This is Yardley Smith putting her foot. Oh, now!
Oh my goodness!
How would you describe that, Yardley?
So this is a fabulous suede ankle boot with a heel that looks like a heel they had, like Louis XIV. Mm-hmm. And we actually call it the Louis heel, shaped like a woman. Really, it's got a little flare at the bottom.
Louis XIV wore heels.
Yeah.
Really, I did not know that. La-di-da.
He was very la-di-da. He wore a lot of brocade, or maybe it's the 16th. One of those.
Okay.
The Louis heel.
Okay.
All the heels actually are named after kings, and all the shoes have girls' names. So this one is Claudine, and I give them all us a little bios. I know. Jim's looking at me like, you have lost your mind.
A lot of us are into women's shoes, actually. And by the way, just as we said before, if you just tune in, you're unveiling your spring collection tonight. It's 6:30 at Solomore, another great name of a store. And Andor, so what are you doing exactly?
It's what we call a PA, a personal appearance, and we're in about 40 high-end boutiques around the country. And these stores do so beautifully by us, but it really helps to build the relationship, and I get to meet the customers if I go and say, hey, I design the shoes, tell me what you think and what you like. And my favorite story is women who say to me, I thought that I'd had to swear off high heels, as you say, and now I can wear Inez. Inez is our best-selling pump. Inez is a school principal by day, dancer at the Moulin Rouge at night.
Really?
Yeah.
Hey, describe what it looks like, please.
It's a beautiful, classic, basic pump like from the 1940s, actually with the same Louis heel, which is funny. When I launched it, they said, Yardley, the heel's too fat. It won't fly. I'm like, you're wrong. Women will look at this and go, I know this shoe can get me where I need to go.
Uh-huh.
And it's so sexy on the foot. I mean, it doesn't look like your ordinary pump, but it's lovely.
How many hours a week do you work in The Simpsons?
Six? About six.
That's the whole deal.
Yeah.
And do you wake up in the morning? I mean, this totally sincerely.
To think about shoes, Jim.
Well, that was the joke, that I worked 6 hours on The Simpsons for years and years, and now I actually have a job being CEO of some Marchevo. I'm like, what were you thinking, Yardley? That was so stupid.
And again, that's Yardley Smith, the voice of Lisa Simpson, the woman behind Marchevo Shoes, 877-301-8970. If you want to talk to her, do you wake up mornings and say, I can't believe I am part of one of the greatest cultural phenomena of the last century? And that's not it is surreal, the impact The Simpsons have had on American life. I'm serious. Do you have that feeling?
I do. And, you know, at the same time, so you walk that duality of having that realization as well as it being a job. It's my job. But I'm reminded at some point every day I get recognized by somebody who says, you have brought me so much laughter. I love everything that you do. And, oh, my God, Herman's Head or The Legend of Billie Jean or some awful film that I've been in. And I've been in several. And it's lovely.
Were you in City – City Slickers.
Yeah.
That was a funny movie.
That was a great movie.
So funny.
Yes, it was a very funny movie. But you know what? I should give the numbers again. 877-301-8970 if you want to talk to Yardley Smith, the voice of Lisa and the creator of these wonderful new shoes. You know what? What I'd love you to comment on is I remember there was controversy, and I watched The Simpsons for years. My kids all love The Simpsons, about Marge and Homer and the marriage and the family. To me, it was a great show because it wasn't Father Knows Best. Everybody wasn't wonderful. So if you had kind of a little weird family, a little off in certain ways, you saw your family on TV. What did you think of the Marge-Homer marriage?
You know, the thing about The Simpsons was, because I remember that controversy.
Yes.
And even it was first President Bush, I think, got in on the commentary as well and said, we're evil. Yeah.
He did?
Oh, yeah. We should all be more like the Waltons and less like The Simpsons. And where he had entirely missed the point is at the end of the day, The Simpsons really do love each other. And while they have their flaws and their foibles, they were never out to get each other. You know, they were maybe not as balanced as you might be in a fairy tale, but they would lie down on the tracks for each other, always, always, always.
So Homer loves Marge.
He does, to death.
To
death. To absolute
death.
It's
great.
And even Bart, you know, the rivalry between Bart and Lisa is so, so beautifully drawn. It's so fantastically crafted because he doesn't want to care for his sister, but he can't not. And they do that wonderfully.
Before we get to the calls, and the lines are full, very quick, do you ever forget that Lisa Simpson is not real? When you're doing,
oh yeah,
when
she
you're
seems
all together,
quite real to me.
That's true, is
yeah,
it not?
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like when the show is over, it'll be as though one of my dearest friends has moved away and is never coming back.
But
I will be in a fetal position.
But she's also a great model for little girls.
No,
is
she's
she
the
not?
Best.
Okay, why is she a great
Seriously,
model?
Because she's smart,
yep,
and empathic and compassionate and funny. Like
Very.
One of my favorite things about Lisa Simpson is her sense of humor. She has a fantastic sense
you
of humor.
You are Lisa Simpson, aren't you? You think you are.
She is much smarter than
No, I'm serious.
No,
that's,
seriously.
Let's take some calls. There are a ton of them. We're talking to Yardley Smith, both the voice of Lisa Simpson and the woman behind Marche Vu Shoes. Again, they're going to be unveiled tonight, her spring collection, 6:30. It's Sol Amour in Andover. You can go meet her.
Let's go to Tony from Lynn. You're on the phone with Lisa from The Simpsons.
Hi, Tony.
Hi, how are you?
I'm terrific.
My question was, are you actually like Lisa Simpson? Are you a vegetarian and interested in the environment and stuff?
No, I don't give a crap about the environment, and I eat lots of meat. No, of course. I mean, I actually do like a hamburger. I was a vegetarian for a short while, and I got too hungry, so I'm not that anymore. But I, you know, we actually share a lot of similarities. I would say on a deeper level, when I was growing up, I too didn't know quite where I fit in. I had friends, but I didn't ever feel like the most popular kid. I was not that girl. So I share that. And I also feel as though anytime you're really super good at something, like Lisa is a prodigy in so many ways, it sets you apart from your peer group. And now you are absolutely automatically irrefutably different. And that's tough.
Let's go to Jane in Groton. You're on with Yardley Smith, otherwise known as Lisa Simpson and Marche Vu. Hey, Jane.
Hi,
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I'm calling actually about your shoes, but I have another question. Do you have a shoe that might work for a pronator?
Well, you know, we don't specialize in specialty shoes like or orthotics and arch support, but we have a really wide range of shoes. We have flats, we have boots, both knee high and ankle. We have about 5 different heel heights, so you should come and see for yourself.
Okay.
As
oh,
I say,
I'm absolutely going to. Yep.
Women who say they don't wear heels anymore get into a pair of Marche Vus and walk out with 5 pairs. So,
yeah. Well,
what's your other question, Jane?
My other question is, I just want to tell you I love you, but how long have you been on the air with The Simpsons?
We just started recording our 25th season.
Wow.
So pretty much since the beginning of time.
Both of my sons and my daughters have listened to you all of those years. One is now 42, the other is now 31. I mean, it's just been wonderful. And also, everything you've done is wonderful.
Oh,
so
thank you.
You're just, and I'm sure now with your shoes, they are wonderful. So
oh, you're so kind. Thank you, Lynn.
Hey, Jane, thanks. Did anyone ever say anything mean to you at all?
I mean, I had a guy in the airport not long ago say, I know you. You're that girl with that annoying voice. How are you? I'm like, really? Do you hear yourself, sir? I mean, people talk to you as though you're still inside the television and you can't actually hear them. And it's a really strange, funny, intimate
That's
relationship
very funny.
Where they have been in their underwear watching you. You've not actually been privy to that
yes,
part
that's
of
true.
The equation.
That's
but
true.
But they treat you like you have been.
But
so.
Then they comment on Maggie with the pacifier sound. I love
oh,
the little
brilliant, isn't it?
It's brilliant.
I feel like she says more without saying a word than any of us say in all our paragraphs of
yeah,
dialogue.
The expressions on her face.
Yeah.
One of our colleagues just asked in our ear, how do they make that sound? What's
oh,
that?
It's Matt Groening did it originally, and he's...
The creator, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's pretty great. That's pretty good yourself. Thanks.
Well, you know.
Do you guys ever think about how much fun it'd be if you switch roles for a show and didn't tell the public? Could you do anybody else? Who could you do on the show?
I can't do anybody.
Yes, you could.
And, no, and the blessed thing is nobody can do me. So even though I only do one voice, I think I have a little bit of job security.
Let's go to Jonathan in Seekonk. You are on the air with Yardley Smith. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Hi, how you doing? I'm just calling because, like, I grew up with The Simpsons, like, watching the show, and I loved it. And you already sort of touched on this question, but hearing you through the radio, like, I know that you're the voice actress of The Simpsons, and I can't tell if that's just because I was told that, but, like, I feel like I can really hear Lisa in your voice. When you're out in public a lot, do people recognize you?
They do, and also on the telephone. And it's great for telemarketers who call and say, can I speak to your parents? I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry, they're not here. So I quite expect social services to show up any day and go, this child has been alone for years. What is happening?
Jonathan, thank you for the call. Do you say you've been doing this more than a quarter of a century?
Yeah.
Are there days when you say, I don't want to be just Lisa Simpson. I'm an actress. You've done a lot of things. Are there those moments for you?
Of course, you know, but I feel as though, you know, if I have to be remembered for one thing, I'd certainly be proud for it to be Lisa. I think in our business,
not
regardless
the Louis 16th
of
pump. What are you talking about? Hardly, please.
Well, you know, it's funny. In show business, they love to put you in a box. It's just easier. Would you just do that thing that we've seen you do that we know you can do?
Do you not get jobs because of that? I mean, we've talked about one of my favorite television shows ever was The Sopranos.
Mm.
And you can never see a Tony, yes. At least I can't, in any other role, even though he's a fabulous actor. Do you run up against that? People say you are Lisa Simpson. You can't be anybody else.
Yes, I think I do think that happens. But more than that, I think people think I don't want to work.
Mm-hmm.
They go, you have this job. It's been on since the beginning of time. You get paid really well. Why would you want to come down from your castle? I'm like, what about my soul?
Mm-hmm.
I like to work because it feeds my soul. And they're like, yeah.
Soul is a perfect segue to Marche Vu, by the way. It's very clever, Yardley Smith.
Our numbers are 877, or number is, I should say, 877-301-89. If you want to talk to Yardley Smith, the creator of the voice of Lisa on The Simpsons and also the creator of this wonderful line of shoes. Before we get back to Lisa for a second, though, I mean, you must have thought about this. There's almost like a conspiratorial thing about women's shoes.
Yes.
That is cruel. I mean, on the one hand, you do look better. You know, your legs look better in a heel.
Yeah.
On the other hand, they're going to ruin your feet. You're going to
ruin
your feet. And you worry about, you know, when you get to be like 70 years old, how many where we place in orthotic shoes?
Will I be hobbling around?
It's the logical end of all this, trying to stuff your feet into, like, Cinderella in the shoes.
Yes.
So what's it about?
Well, what's fascinating is when I got into the shoe business, it's run by straight, middle-aged men. Fascinating.
And what's wrong with straight middle-aged men?
Nothing, but one presumes they're not test driving the product like we are.
Yes.
So it is. I feel it's sort of presumptuous, you know, as we will. I hope that we actually launch into men's shoes because the PS
is. That's my next question, actually.
No, Jim, I can't tell you how many men come up to me when their wives, you know, depart my side and say, I got to tell you, we're in really big trouble, too. We have dress shoes that are so uncomfortable. I have blood coming out of my eyes. So I'm like, OK. So but it's a funny space for me to say I know what a man would like. I know as a woman what I'd like to see a man like.
You know what you need? You need a straight middle-aged man as part of Marche
Vu. Are you free?
I know some people who have my people talk to your people. Let's squeeze one more really quick. You got to be fast. Karen from Boston, you got a great question for Yardley Smith. Go quickly, please.
Hi, I love you guys.
Thanks.
My question is why doesn't your shoes have smaller sizes? I'm actually looking at it right now on the website, and all the shoe sizes start at 6.
Because to do a size run of molds from 6 to size 11, including all the half sizes, costs $50,000. Since I own my company and I have no big muscle behind it, I need to, at this point, make some judicious decisions about that sort of thing. But there is a future where we get into sizes 5 and 5.5.
Beautifully. Now, inside Yardley Smith, you can meet her tonight. You can pretend you're there for the shoes when you're really there to see Lisa Simpson. No, she's there for
kidding?
The shoes.
There'll be lots of people there for the shoes.
She
Jim.
Is unveiling.
Don't
she
worry
made a
about
look
it.
At me. Unveiling her spring 2013 footwear collection, 6:30 tonight at Sol Amor and Ender. When's the men's line happen? I'm serious.
We're going to sample it for spring 2014, which is in development
fabulous.
Now.
There you
Yardley
go.
Smith, you're great. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can find us at wgbhnews.org/PPR. Tomorrow, Gabriel Gomez, no longer longer a stealth candidate running for the U.S. Senate, former Navy SEAL. He'll be here. The news quiz and a local writer takes on Philip Ross' Portnoy's Complaint, one of my favorite books. I am Jim Browdy.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
Bye, Yardley Smith, and see you guys tomorrow at noon.